Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
I was born with my papa's son wandering out of a smoking gun. Some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. Huh. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. I feel alright. I feel alright tonight.
All right, all right, all right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here on a Monday morning. And that means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because we always have a joke for you ready to go on Monday morning. So my dad's going to do that. We got the Monday morning movie reviews with Eric Childress and Steve Procopi. That's coming up. We got the box office as well. We are going to talk about some of the best modern movies that were made in black and white, because one of the movies that came out this week was shot in black and white. And we're going to talk about guilty pleasure movies. So that's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. And there you go. All right. It is Monday morning, and we're ready to go here for the week. I'm your overnight guy, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Let me say hello to my producer, Tom Hush. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, man?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Doing very all right.
You have a good weekend?
Yeah, great weekend. A lot of time spent at the movies this weekend.
Yeah. You saw some stuff.
Yeah. Caught up on some stuff that I missed from last week when I was gone. I saw Zombieland Double Tap.
Mm-hmm.
Had a good time with that. And then, of course, The Lighthouse and my favorite of the week, Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah. Jojo Rabbit, we're going to review both of those. Did you watch Dolomite Is My Name?
I did. Oh, my God.
So entertaining.
It's weird to think that a Netflix release that, you know, barely anybody had the chance to see in theaters is probably going to wind up one of the, I think it's going to be one of the best of the year.
Oh, there's no question about it. And it's the best thing Eddie Murphy's done in years.
It was just so much fun to watch. And even for people who have no context as to who Rudy Ray Moore is or Dolomite or any of that, really had a good time. My girlfriend really enjoyed watching it. She thought it was just really funny, really insightful look into a specific time in American filmmaking.
And, people are comparing it to Ed Wood. The same guys wrote it, wrote Ed Wood. And it is the same kind of thing. It's like people sincerely trying to make something, even though the product is not good. That's like with Ed Wood, you know, he made terrible movies, but he was really sincere about it. And that's kind of what happens here. Because you feel for Rudy Ray Moore. You feel for him.
Yeah, he's an outsider. He feels left behind. He feels like he's got something to say, but people don't want to listen.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he finally gives in to just being himself, that's when things start to go right for him in a lot of ways, and having a lot of self-confidence. It's really a movie about, hey, believe in yourself.
No, that's exactly what it is, yeah. By the way, Wesley Snipes is so good in it. It's such a great performance. When he plays Dervil Martin, who's actor slash director of the Dolomite movies, and the first time he reacts to Rudy Ray Moore doing kung fu is one of the funniest things. Is one of the funniest things I've seen ever. It was like his reaction to him.
Just awesome.
Just fantastic. But yeah, it was, the only weird thing is that the movie is about them making Dolomite, but it's the human tornado that they're reenacting.
Right.
That was the only thing I was like, why?
Yeah, some interesting choices there, but it was remarkable. I saw a lot of things on the web talking about it, praising it, especially for how they managed to get just shot perfect recreations.
Oh yeah.
Of Rudy Ray Moore and
oh Murphy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It
was no, just,
it looks exactly the same.
No, it's absolutely meticulous. I mean, if you're a fan, I guess I've seen the Dolomite movies like 9,000 times. But yeah, so
I just want a sequel where they make Petey Wheatstraw.
See, that's the see for me. It's Disco Godfather.
That'd be fun too.
Disco
That'd
Godfather. Be super fun. Call an ambulance and tell me what he has had. Guy ODs in the disco. So anyway, yeah. Anyways, it's available now on Netflix, and it's a very entertaining movie. And the best thing Eddie Murphy's done in many a year. So very entertaining stuff. Let's see. In the newsroom, it's Vic Vaughn. Vic, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Yeah.
For a Monday.
It is Monday.
Yeah, I'm feeling good. I had a great weekend, and so
fun weekend.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got to see the inside of the Chicago theater. I waited way too long.
That's right. How was the concert?
It was good.
Yeah.
Ray LaMontagne sounds well. He sounds just like he does on his, you know, CDs or albums. I mean, he's what a vocalist.
Yeah.
Really good. He had an opening. Two people opened for him too. Casey and Clayton. From Canada,
uh-huh.
They were hilarious,
and
Casey has just a beautiful voice. So it was all in all, really fun night.
Yeah. Now you'd never been to the Chicago Theater.
No, I hadn't been inside there, so that was my. We got to take the tour too, because I've heard that's really cool.
It's great, and my thing is, I grew up going to that theater, but it was in terrible condition when I was a kid. Like, because all of the downtown loop movie theaters that used to be. In that area, because there was like a movie theater every two feet. There were movie theaters all over the place. And those are the movie theaters that I went to when I was a kid, but they were in terrible shape when I was a kid in the 70s.
Yeah.
I mean, there was rodent infestation. The seats were all ripped apart. They were just, you know, but then when they reopened the Chicago Theater, it was closed in, they closed it down in the mid-80s, and then they reopened it. It took a couple of years or about a year and a half to redo it, and when they did it, it's, I mean, obviously you were there Saturday night. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Yeah. I'm sure that people who work there every day can point out a billion things that are wrong with it, but just to the the ticket holder, you walk in, it's beautiful.
Oh, it's a beautiful theater.
Of course,
yeah.
Jeannie spotted some peeling paint on the ceiling and pointed it out to me, but other than that, yeah. It was
well,
really
I mean,
in good shape.
If you were to see that theater like in 1977, yeah.
Well, it's probably comparable to the last time I was at, oh man, I'm drawing a blank. What's the name of that theater? Help me out here. I think it's around maybe the California stop on the blue line.
Congress?
Yes, thank
Congress.
You. Congress. Last time I was in that, wow. But it was about 5 years ago.
I know it's
under work, or maybe the work's done now.
I haven't been there. I haven't been there in years.
Strong urine smell in the seats that I was sitting in.
I remember going to see the Pogues there, and it was in pretty bad shape.
Now, I saw Merle Haggard there, and he was actually all about ready to walk out. He stopped playing because the sound system just sounded terrible.
Yeah.
And so he was almost going to walk out, and he ended up just playing as loud as he could without the sound system. It was not very good.
Oh, man.
I believe it's probably much better shape now. They've been working on it for a while. It might
be
down.
I haven't been there. Seriously, it's been years since I'm trying to remember the last show I saw at the Congress. It was a long time ago.
That one's another one that's just got potential to be great if they can, you know.
Yeah, well, there were so many beautiful theaters in this city. You know, we don't have them anymore. I mean, the only one that we have that's active is Music Box. But there used to be theaters like that every four blocks. These beautiful auditoriums that I grew up going to movie palaces when I was a kid, and then neighborhood theaters. Some of them were really gorgeous, and really beautiful. And they were just in the neighborhood. They were just, there was a theater called the Commodore on Irving Park, that was an absolutely gorgeous theater. And, you know, obviously if you've gone to the Music Box, we've got the patio on the northwest side where they're trying to rehab that place. And they do some interesting programming over there. And sometimes it's just free. Sometimes they're just like, hey, let's show a movie. My parents live right around the corner from the patio. And, but there used to be theaters like that all over the place.
Yeah.
Man, man, oh, man. Well, anyway, the Chicago Theater is a beautiful place. Beautiful, beautiful place. So, all right. But yes, we're lamenting the loss of the big movie theaters in the city. I do that all the time. I get all sad about it. But there are plenty of movies out there to see, and we're going to review a bunch of them right now. After we take this break, we will have Eric and Steve, and we will review all the new movies right here on 720 WGN, 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
The BMO Harris Bank Magnificent Mile Lights Festival returns on November 22nd and 23rd. Grand Marshals Mickey and Minnie Mouse from Walt Disney World illuminate more than 1 million lights in this Saturday tree lighting parade. Then fireworks over the Chicago River. Details at WGNradio.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline Studio on WGN here in downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. I am your overnight dude every weekday morning, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. And it is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And we got the Monday morning movie reviews in just a couple of minutes. And we're also going to talk about modern movies that were shot in black and white, tying in with a movie that came out this weekend. We are also going to talk about some of the guilty pleasure movies. So if you, there are movies out there that you feel guilty about liking, well, we're going to talk about that as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. Stay connected with us on our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. So there you go. All right. Every Monday morning, Eric Childress and Steve Procopi join me to review the new movies. And let's get the guys in here. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right. So let's get to it. Well, first of all, I just want to mention, I know we reviewed it. You guys reviewed it already. I watched Dolomite Is My Name. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. Eddie Murphy is phenomenal in it, and clearly his best performance in years. And my God, Wesley Snipes! Oh
yep.
My God! So anyway, it was great. The only weird thing is that they, you know, that, and you mentioned this. You guys mentioned this already. Is that they were actually in the movie? They're shooting Human Tornado,
right?
That's not Dolomite, but that's my only sort of quibble about the movie. Other than that, it's fantastic. It's so entertaining and so funny. And if you're a fan of those movies, which I am, it's just it's great. And it's nice to see Eddie Murphy just kicking ass again. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's great in it. And I just wanted to mention that really quickly. I know we reviewed it officially last week, but it's on Netflix now, and I can't recommend it highly enough. It is incredibly funny and very, very entertaining. So. All right, Steve, let's start out with Western Stars. This is the Springsteen movie.
Yes.
All right.
Sure. Over the last few years, Bruce Springsteen has sort of taken his skills as a teller of other people's stories and turned that into a trio, a triptych, if you will, of very deeply considered and endlessly moving projects, starting out with a memoir a few years ago, and then, of course, his one-man Broadway show, which ended at the end of last year, and now a film that seems to sort of tie everything together. Western Stars is sort of part concert film, part reflective documentary. It marks Springsteen's directing debut along with his frequent collaborator Tom Zimney, who also directed the Springsteen on Broadway Netflix special. And it consists of performances of all 13 songs from his most recent album, as well as one cover song to kind of close out the whole experience. Between the songs, which are performed in a sort of dramatic cathedral-like setting of his of this 100-year-old barn that's on his property in New Jersey, the co-directors have placed this sort of interstitial material of Springsteen looking very deep in thought as he kind of strolls through the California desert as if he's looking for answers to the many issues brought up during his narration, sort of spelling out some of his lifelong troubles and joys and continuing concerns. And in these short films, he ties his struggles and thoughts together into specific sort of song introductions, making it clear that the Western Stars album is more than just a collection of his latest songs, but it's more of a summary of these life story chronicles that he's been creating in these last couple years. He just turned 70 last month.
Wow.
So it's not surprising that the guy who is so gifted with words might have a few thoughts on growing older, the healing power of family and the country that he spent his entire life attempting to understand and reflect upon in his music. The performances include this band, sort of a newer band, as well as a full orchestra with strings and horns and a small chorus of backup singers. Most important to this music, this particular music and the stories he's telling here, are his wife, Patti Scalfa, is also in the band, and she sings two songs as duets with Springsteen, which result in compositions that are very different than the recorded versions. I think they're better, actually. Tom Zimney, the co-director, also serves as the film's editor, and he kind of weaves some really touching archival footage throughout the in-between segments, including home movies of Bruce and Patty on their honeymoon in the early 1990s, that shows a side of Springsteen that's a lot more playful than we're used to seeing. And I'm pretty sure he's drunk in some of these clips, so that's even funnier. But through these quick glimpses into his personal life, the deeper meaning of the music is revealed even further. It's interesting, the song that the cover song that closes the movie is Rhinestone Cowboy, which is written by Larry Weiss, but obviously popularized by Glen Campbell in 1975, and that blows me away because that's the same year that Springsteen's song and album Born to Run came out, and it's fascinating to think that those two songs existed in the same exact moment in history because they seem so different, like different from different eras. But I kind of dig the idea that after sort of watching this 80-minute thing with Springsteen wearing a cowboy hat and cowboy clothing and riding horses and walking among the cacti of the Joshua Tree National Park, it's kind of amusing to think that the singer in that song, he might see himself in that character. And especially when it comes to surviving and making it, and especially when the chips are down, and for Springsteen, those chips were a rough relationship with his father that resulted in a lifelong battle with depression. So in many ways, the song is a perfect closer to this really beautiful big screen musical experience. So I highly recommend it.
Oh, wow. Okay. Where's it playing?
I know it's at River East, and it's in their Dolby Theater too, which I haven't seen it there. I saw it a little earlier before it opened, but I definitely want to go back and see it that way.
Okay, all right. Those Dolby Theaters are great.
Yeah,
they really are. Okay, cool. So that's Western Stars. It's out right now. All right, Eric, you're the only one who saw Black and Blue.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Lucky. Okay. Well, this one stars Naomi Harris as a cop, former Army veteran who comes back to her hometown of New Orleans and becomes a rookie cop. She's partnered up with Reed Scott from Veep, and when he wants off for the evening, she takes a shift for him and is partnered up with another guy who is working with the narcs in the division, one of whom played by Frank Grillo. And as they patrol through the evening and into the morning, they come upon a call in an abandoned, well, practically an abandoned part of town. And she witnesses a couple of the cops, including Frank Grillo's character, assassinate a drug dealer. And she catches it all on her body cam. One of the cops basically kind of freaks out and shoots her. She ends up having to sort of stroll through the town, partially wounded, trying to find shelter from not just these three cops, but apparently every cop in New Orleans that's patrolling the area is on the payroll of these either drug dealers or connected with Grillo's character. Tyrese Gibson plays a member of the community, someone that she used to know from years ago, though he certainly is reluctant to hide her in his home. He does so, and it becomes this sort of cat-and-mouse game throughout the film, with her hiding from the cops and the community not wanting to hide her As you can tell, this is kind of, you know, a little bit ripped from the headlines a bit. This is the second film of the year from director Deon Taylor. He also directed the film The Intruder, the crazy psychological thriller with Dennis Quaid,
right,
earlier in the film. And I, you know, dare I say that that film is actually a bit more realistic. At the very least, this one is kind of very, is quite off-putting in the way that it's trying to make some sort of commentary between cops and the African American community, and really just kind of making both sides look really bad. Early on in the film, it's kind of remarkable the way that Deon Taylor, who is black, actually shoots some of the, and I mean with the camera, some of the, you know, many of the people in the African American community in New Orleans. He the slow pans, they all look mean. It's almost like you're watching a horror movie to some extent. But then, you know, it gets into, you know, whether, you know, the kind of, you know, police-involved shootings and, you know, the, you know, body cams. You never heard the term body cam spoken so much in
all right,
a movie.
Eric, hang on for a second, okay?
Sure.
We got to take a quick break. We'll get back to this. Eric and Steve are with us. It's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. When we get back, Eric will tell us more about the movie Black and Blue. And then we got more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about great modern movies that were shot in black and white, and we're going to talk about guilty pleasure movies, too. Got plenty of those to get to. And much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. All righty then. Before the break, you know, Eric and Steve are here to review the movies. Before the break, Eric was telling us about this new film called Black and Blue. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, continue, Eric. Black and Blue.
Yeah, so as I was saying, you know, I mean, the entire movie is the cops basically trying to hunt her down, trying to get her body cam footage before she can find a way to, you know, expose it and get it back to the precinct so it can be uploaded into the system. It's almost like a Strange Days kind of feel to that, and what Angela Bassett's character was going through towards the end of that movie. But, you know, as much as this movie wants to be, you know, this sort of this commentary, you know, whether it be about Black Lives Matter or the police-involved shootings, it's still trying to, you know, wrestle itself within the guise of a thriller. And in that aspect, it's quite a failure as well. It's not a particularly thrilling movie. Any twist that the movie has, which there are, you know, a couple minor ones, can be seen coming a mile away. So there's absolutely nothing to respond to when the movie wants to take one of these turns. With the exception of the Naomi Harris character, who is, again, they're also trying to play up this idea of how people sort of abandoned New Orleans, and the only people that were basically left are pretty much the worst you could possibly imagine, including the cops, and everyone in the community is somehow connected to this one drug dealer. So just like nobody in this movie really comes off particularly great. And this movie doesn't exactly so much wear its influences on its sleeve as it basically is just sort of telegraphing all the parts of all these other movies that it takes from. Clearly there is a lot of Training Day in this film. There's bits of from Night Falls on Manhattan and the revolve with the drug dealers and the cops in that movie. And then when all else fails, they basically give you a finale that is practically right out of The Professional. It doesn't really work as an action thriller. It's kind of insulting the way that it's trying to deal with the real life issues. It's not particularly well acted. Frank Grillo is pretty bad in the movie as the villain. Tyrese Gibson is really trying to tone it down as best he can to play sort of an everyman. That doesn't work. Naomi Harris is certainly trying, doing her best, but she's not given a whole lot to work here other than just sort of run around from people. By the end, when everybody is just sort of shooting each other, you're really trying to imagine what this movie was actually trying to say about the things that it was trying to venture forth. This is a pretty bad film.
Okay. All right. So that's Black and Blue. It's out right now. There you go. All right. Steve, you tell us about Countdown.
Yeah. This is what we are calling a Halloween release now. There's a nurse named Quinn who's played by Elizabeth Lail. I don't know her. I've never seen her before, but she downloads this app that claims to predict the moment when a person will die, and it tells her she only has 3 days to live. So with the clock ticking and a weird, mysterious figure haunting her, she must find a way to save her life before her time runs out. Along her journey, she is sexually harassed by a doctor at the hospital where she works, who's played by Peter Facinelli, because who else would it be played by? Her younger sister is also downloads the app and finds out she's only got a couple minutes more to live than her. And then she also meets a guy named Matt, who's played by Jordan Calloway, who is also scheduled to die fairly soon, a couple hours before them, if I'm not mistaken. The threat itself is a little uncertain. Apparently these deaths were going to happen anyway, so if you, as they call it, void the terms of the agreement of the app by trying to change your schedule or your routine in order to stay alive, this sort of cloaked demon-like creature comes anyway and shows up and kills you when it's your time, regardless of what you do. So naturally, Quinn and Matt consult a priest, because that's what you would do, and he figures out that the app is actually similar to an ancient curse, and he gives them a possible way of getting out of it, which is to either kill someone earlier than they're supposed to die, according to the app, which doesn't seem very cool, or figure out a way to stay alive even just a second longer than the countdown clock says you will. So while Countdown does have a few effective scares and some low-level creepy vibes to it, it seems kind of scrapped together from other much better films of this nature, most of which were remakes of Japanese horror films to begin with. Like I said, Elizabeth Lail is fine, I guess, as Quinn, but the film kind of paints her as kind of crappy to her father and her sister after her mom died, and it doesn't really do that much to explain why she's like that or for her to make amends for it. There's a sense that there's more to that story, but that got chopped out in order just to get to the scary stuff. I did like a couple scenes with comedian Tom Segura. He's in it as a cell phone sales guy / hacker who comes up with a temporary solution to the deadline countdown problem, the deadly countdown problem. The demon-like figure is kind of a bust, too, because sometimes it comes in the form of a really recently deceased person that was close to the next person that's about to die, and it makes the whole film a bit confusing. The writer-director is Justin Deck, I think is how you say his name. This is his first feature. He's done a lot of shorts, but mainly it looks like he used to be a production assistant on a lot of much bigger films than this. It's an okay first film, I guess, but like I said, it's kind of a bummer that this is the one new horror film that audiences have available to them for Halloween. So I would say this is not recommended by me.
Okay. What do you think, Eric?
Well, I'm not recommending it either, but I do find myself defending certain aspects to it because I did. It was a bit better than I was expecting it, given that I was thinking this was going to be another sort of crappy PG-13, you know, movie that Steve said kind of slapped together in the likes of that we've seen, you know, with ideas like this that have ripped off ideas from better horror movies, movies like Wish Upon or even like Slender Man, which are just bottom of the barrel dregs. This movie, I think, actually has some ideas to it and a couple clever ones, but it always seems to be just sort of one giant step behind every single one of those ideas. Like the quick fix that you mentioned with the cell phone guy. I'm like, okay, that's clever. This clearly is not going to work, but I think that was actually kind of clever. I thought that the actor playing the priest is quite annoying, but I like that they were decided to just get a little goofy with it. They recognize that the premise is a bit goofy, so let's have a bit of fun with it. And so things like that, I think, work to an extent. I mean, they were better than just the sort of the average thing that I was expecting. Like, for example, I'm just kind of glad that it wasn't like every time someone downloaded the app, they immediately have like 3 days to die. That was like a set thing every time. Some people download the app and they have 58 years to live. It's the literal prediction of or when you're supposed to die, and other people get 3 days. They never really quite get into the terms of the terms and conditions and how they violate it by somehow knowing that they're going to die a certain way, because no one who violates anything in the movie seems to know how they're quite going to die, except maybe in the opening scene. So it just didn't seem like how anyone couldn't violate the terms and agreements of this app. So they never quite, make that clear. Again, the ending's kind of silly. The resolution of how they kind of get away with it. They do really go there with the sexual harassment stuff in the movie. It seems like it's played up a bit, but when you have a character fighting that guy off towards the end of the movie and saying your time's up, is talk about double entendres. I'm not recommending the film, but you could clearly do a lot worse on your PG-13 list of horror movies.
Okay. All right, guys, hang on.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Eric and Steve are hanging on. We come back, we got more movies to review on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline Studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's Monday, and if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Eric Childress, Steve Procopi join me every Monday morning for the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, and that's what we're doing right now. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thanks.
Okay, Steve, tell us about the current war.
I'll tell you
directors,
about part of it.
Director's cut.
Yes. I can only tell you about the director's cut. And I'm guessing we don't have anyone on the phone that has seen both versions, but maybe. So on the surface, it would make sense that the premier inventor, Thomas Edison, who's played by Benedict Cumberbatch here, and industrialist George Westinghouse, who's played by Michael Shannon, should have spent some part of their careers working together and creating and mass producing all manner of technology to better the lives of Americans from coast to coast. What in fact happened, at least the way it's laid out in the current war, is that these two spent years basically at war in a cutthroat competition to see who would supply light and power to the country on a city-by-city basis. And somewhere in their midst danced a strange young genius immigrant named Nikola Tesla, who's played by Nicholas Holt, who had better ideas than either of these guys about how to electrify America. But because he was sort of strange and broke and spoke with an accent, no one really took him seriously. The film is, and Eric, you can correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong. The film is directed by Alfonso Gomez Rayon, who did Me and Earl and the Dying Girl a couple of years ago,
right.
And produced by Martin Scorsese. The film is being released with the subtitle of Director's Cut because the film premiered 2 years ago at the Toronto Film Festival in a cut that was apparently supervised by the distributor, a guy named Harvey Weinstein. Once the film was sold off, I guess it was given back to the filmmaker, who kind of restored it or at least did something to it to make it different than the version that played at Toronto and was not very well received. I don't know what the differences are, but what I saw was still something that felt quite overblown, but not without merit on some points. The challenge, of course, is to make this battle between direct current and alternating current technologies seem interesting. So both Edison and Westinghouse put on these elaborate displays of their ideas for the press while feeding some direct lies about their competitor systems to the press, even going so far, Edison goes so far as to say that Westinghouse's designs could actually result in death. The film does a fairly admirable job detailing the relationships both men had with their wives. Tuppence Middleton plays Mary Edison, who Edison left alone quite frequently while he was working to all hours on a regular basis. And Catherine Waterston plays Marguerite Westinghouse, from whom George rarely was separated, and they had a really lovely relationship. Both women are portrayed not only as companions, but sometimes actual contributors to the process of sort of cracking this technology and its flaws. And truth be told, Edison seems more devoted to his personal assistant, who's played by Tom Holland. In the film and in real life, all roads kind of lead to the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893 in Chicago, which gives the filmmakers a really great opportunity to recreate the World's Fair in era Chicago, which looks amazing even if it's completely computer generated. The organizers of the World's Fair took bids to see who would supply electricity to the fair, so there was some scrambling that commenced in the Edison and Westinghouse camps, and again, meanwhile, on the fringes, Tesla is just sort of fighting to be heard within the Westinghouse company where he worked for a time. Look, as far as production design and costumes, the current war is impressive, but Cumberbatch feels like he's overplaying things a lot. Michael Shannon certainly fares better, and he gives Westinghouse a bit of a fragile soul while never letting go of his sort of sharp instinct for business. I like the portrait of Edison as a hypocrite who refused to sell his technology to anyone who wanted to weaponize it, but when he needed cash, he took a commission to design a quote-unquote humane means of executing death row prisoners, and he ended up inventing the electric chair. So the film, like these people, is deeply flawed, but it tells a type of war story that we don't get to see very frequently, one sort of on the corporation end, on the inventor end, and it's curious. It's a curious film. It's sometimes interesting, and I guess I'm kind of down the middle on it, maybe leaning toward recommending it slightly just because it is something a little different.
Okay. All right. Eric, what about you?
I appreciate the reminder that Steve just gave me because I did see the movie in 2017 at the Toronto Film Festival premiere of that film. This was just a few weeks, I guess, maybe about a month before the whole Harvey Weinstein thing blew up. And the film was actually scheduled to be released that Christmas for award season. But even given the response it was at Toronto, including my own, it was, you know, scrapped for a variety of reasons. The things that I remember about the movie, obviously, you know, the plotting of the movie, it sounds more interesting than the movie actually presents it. There's a really kind of fascinating history there with Edison and Westinghouse, and specifically with Nikola Tesla, who I feel is kind of just used as kind of this pawn between the two men, and it's just really kind of like, you know, Edison's a jerk, so I'm going to go over here to Westinghouse, and Tesla, I think, is kind of given short shrift in the movie as well. Benedict Cumberbatch, it seems like I've seen him play this role of insufferable genius way too many times, not just, you know, The Imitation Game and the Fifth Estate and now this, and so it's just like I felt like I was just watching the same Cumberbatch performance that I've seen so many times. Shannon, I thought, was a bit better. The one thing that did stand out about the movie that I remember really holding my interest was the cinematography. I thought that this movie actually looked really beautiful, and it certainly has an eye for the lens, and you saw that even when Me and Earl and the Dying Girl. So you saw that he was really, you know, trying to make a film here, but he just didn't have a screenplay that draws the audience into something that is, again, kind of far more far-reaching and interesting than the story that is sort of condensed here. I don't remember exactly how long the movie was at Toronto, if the movie was actually longer. I think it might have been. I'd have to look back at my notes and see if I can find that, because I do seem to remember it was somewhere close to 2 hours. So maybe he shortened it a bit. I don't know if a few minutes excising the thing is going to help that much, because the rest of the movie to me was just kind of a slog, and it's really unfortunate because I was actually kind of really curious and looking forward to this movie, and 2 years later I didn't feel the need to go out and see the director's cut.
All right. Well, it's just such a strange story. This movie, the release of this movie and everything around it. So, all right. Well, that's The Current War, Director's Cut. That's the full title. You guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Eric and Steve are here. You guys hold on. And they review the new movies with me every Monday morning. And we got a couple more movies to review right here on 720 WGN. We'll do that right after this. Everybody, Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and how's it going? We're live in the Skyline studio here on a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. We're going to talk about guilty pleasure movies and modern movies that are shot in black and white, some of the best ones, and more here. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text. You can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and stay connected with us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/Nick D Show. Every Monday morning, Eric and Steve review the new movies with me, and we got a couple more to review. Let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Hello.
All right, Eric, tell us about Jojo Rabbit.
Okay. Well, this is the new film from Taika Waititi that I saw at the Toronto Film Festival this year, and it stars a young actor named Roman Griffin Davis as Johan, who is a 10-year-old boy in Germany towards the sort of the tail end of World War II, and he wants nothing more in the world than to join the Nazi Party. His mom is played by Scarlett Johansson. His father, who we never see, is off fighting in the German army, and he gets a chance to join up with a Hitler Youth group, or Hitler Youth camp, that's run by Sam Rockwell's Nazi character, who's sort of been demoted into training children because of past screw-ups. And he's assisted by Fraulein played Rebel Wilson. And some incidents during the camp involving JoJo's both cowardice and enthusiasm results in him kind of getting kicked out of the camp, only to be reinserted later. And he has an imaginary friend, and his name is Adolf Hitler, played by Taika Waititi, and played in all of the fashion that you would expect a Adolf Hitler played by Taika Waititi to come off on the big screen, offering him advice and, you know, how to be brave and how to be a Nazi and all these wonderful things that you expect to come from Hitler's mouth. But things take a turn in JoJo's life when he discovers that someone is being hidden in his house, a young Jewish girl played by Thomasin McKenzie from Leave No Trace last year, and they kind of strike a devil's bargain. He wants to turn her in. She warns him that if he does, terrible things could happen to him and his mother. So they sort of strike this bargain that he will keep the secret if she tells him all of the secrets about being Jewish, so he can craft something and get on the good side of the Nazis, particularly Rockwell's character. And that's basically the setup for the story. And just describing this movie to someone who might not be familiar with Taika's sensibilities, whoever might make a movie like this, people are going to respond in some way, probably negatively, to the idea that someone is making a comedy involving Adolf Hitler as a wacky side character. That's not exactly something that has been absent in cinema satire throughout the years. You can go back to Chaplin. You can go back to Mel Brooks. Several movies have attempted this, and some have even failed as well. And this movie, I think, gets off to a bit of a rocky start. I think that even if you are on the side of Taika and the opportunity to make this movie, the movie does take a bit of time to sort of get used to. Not that the character of Hitler in the way he's being played is so off-putting, but just finding that basic line between truth and satire that the movie wants to convey. And just how far is it going to take the comic sensibilities of its creator? And I think that once the movie settles into what becomes the primary story of the relationship between the boy and this this Jewish girl, I think the movie then takes on that balance, and I think rather well. The movie doesn't shy away from some of the horrible things that are happening to people around this time, and yet when the movie seems to take itself a bit more seriously, it actually gets a lot funnier. There's scenes in this movie that go at the beginning, come off as goofy, and later on actually almost achieve a level of Python-esque brilliance. And I think Thomasin McKenzie, is the real deal. I think she is extraordinary in this movie. Taika is funny, but a little of the Hitler can go a long way. I think Rockwell is actually much funnier, playing a buffoonish Nazi, and I like the direction that his character went in. The lead, Roman Griffin Davis, I also think is very good in this movie. And as I said, the back half of this movie, when the movie really finds the level, the plane level that it wants to be on, it actually devolves into something very funny and ultimately quite moving. So I came down on the positive side of Jojo Rabbit.
All right. Steve, what'd you think?
Yeah, I mean, Eric's right. It does kind of find its center once the girl Elsa is introduced, and that makes sense, because in the strictest sense, Waititi isn't playing Adolf Hitler. He's playing this kid's perception of Hitler, who's like loving and playful and full of great advice, but it's really just advice from his own head. And what's interesting is that as the film goes on and his friendship with this girl increases, the advice that Hitler is, that Adolf is giving him, as he calls him, sort of adjust and are challenged, but are ultimately overrun by the kid's desire to just be a better person, which is something his mother has sort of been teaching him this whole time. I don't know if you mentioned it, the mother's played by Scarlett Johansson. As much as Jojo Rabbit sort of being pitched as a comedy, the truth is, like, a big part of this film is actually sort of very emotional and sometimes tragic, and treats the sort of overriding realities of war and the Holocaust with the reverence I think it deserves. And what Waititi is targeting is sort of the nonsensical element of any hate group or collection of attitudes that result in prejudice. And in many ways, the film moves through its paces almost like surgery. Like, the filmmaker kind of places laughter in very specific moments where they're needed, and there's no attempt to sanitize the realities of war or genocide, but that doesn't mean that Jojo always understands the weight of everything he's saying or being faced with. There's an amazing scene that involves when the SS comes to Jojo's house, led by a character played by Stephen Merchant, who somehow manages to be both hilarious and genuinely threatening at the same time. And Jojo has this book that he's been keeping about sort of all these ideas and myths about Jewish people and their terrible, hateful ideas. And the SS guys love it, and he has to, and the girl is there in the room for reasons I won't go into, but he has to sort of, you can clearly see he's embarrassed now that he knows her and knows these things aren't true. And it's a really, really moving moment. And there's an actual, like, shift, I think, in everything in that exact moment. But in the end, the film is, like I said, it's as moving as it is challenging. And at its core, it's a story about this boy's world who's turned inside out and upside down on several occasions at the end of the war. His ideals and idols are torn down in rapid succession. And it's not afraid to find moments when laughter helps tell the story and helps the healing even. I think it's a solid piece of conventional farcical filmmaking, and I hope that more filmmakers take chances like this.
Okay. All right, you guys hang on, okay?
Mm-hmm.
All right, we'll take a break here. Eric and Steve are going to hang on. We'll come back. I'll tell you what I thought of Jojo Rabbit, and then we've got another movie to review here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews on 720 WGN.
Of light in the skies over.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It is a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We're going to talk about guilty pleasure movies and black and white movies and all kinds of fun stuff. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. We are doing the Monday morning movie reviews. And let's welcome the guys back. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, just before the break, Eric and Steve reviewed Jojo Rabbit. I got to say, this was not at all the movie I expected it to be. Not at all. I was surprised at just how moving it was. I just expected wacky. I just expected a wacky, you know, comedy. And it's much more than that. It's a lot more than that. And it's a really genuinely moving film. That it does start off a little bit slow. And as you said, once the character Velsa is introduced, that's where it really starts to grab you. I thought both of the kids were fantastic in it. I thought the handling of the Adolf character was done well. It was, you know, it it was, it's very shaky kind of ground to do that kind of thing, you know, to have like, you know, one of the main characters to be Adolf Hitler, or at least a version of imaginary version of Adolf Hitler. But it works. There are some very funny moments in the movie, but the thing that really struck me was just how moving it was. I didn't expect to be emotional about it. You know, I didn't go into this movie thinking that I was going to be, you know, like really emotional. And I was. And I know my producer, Tom, saw the movie over the weekend, and it really affected you, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was, I'm on the same page as you. I did not know how much this is going to get to me.
Yeah.
And I think that when you have to deal with this sort of material, it's totally a fine line that I think ultimately the film manages to walk pretty well. And, you know, I think to me, the movie is less so about trying to say Nazis are bad, because that's kind of self-evident. But I was really struck by the way that it portrays children, and the way that it's a movie about how we fail kids and how kids get strung up in things that are so beyond their years. Like, there's images of kids wielding weapons and everything in the kind of final moments of the war coming to an end for Germany. That just, you know, it was the perfect feeling of satire, where it's like, it's so funny but so true that it makes you cry.
Yeah,
you know, there's a lot of truth to it. So I really thought it was a spectacular film, and I'm a big fan of Taika, so I'm really glad that this got made.
Yeah, it's good stuff. All right, okay guys, well, Steve,
yeah,
why don't you tell us about The Lighthouse?
Man, I knew you were gonna give this one to me. this is one of the hardest things I've ever tried to put notes down for. All right, let me give it a shot. Director and co-writer Robert Eggers is, I'd say, slightly obsessed with history. Even the way he presents the follow-up to his first film, The Witch, shows that. It's stark black and white. The aspect ratio is almost a perfect square, like the early talkies. And, of course, the setting of The Lighthouse is the 1890s. In a lighthouse in a remote, unnamed New England island, and it's there we meet a lighthouse keeper named Thomas, who's played by Willem Dafoe, and his newly arrived underling Ephraim, who's played by Robert Pattinson. And together they have to keep the lighthouse going 24/7, and what ends up happening during the course of their time together is that either one or both of them is going completely insane, and Eggers wants desperately to drag us along with them. I could just stop there, I think, but I won't. The Lighthouse is definitely not so much about story as it is about mythology of the sea and the place where sort of legends and reality blur heavily in sort of a wind and rain swept location that looks very, it looks so lived in you can smell it. And what that smell definitely is farts that ring as loud as any foghorn on the planet. The sheer delight that Dafoe exhibits with each new fart is worth the price of admission. I'm going to say that. And anybody who doesn't think The Lighthouse is primarily a pitch black comedy might be missing something and should probably go see it again, like I'm going to anyway. If there is any villain in the film, aside from the weather and time and creeping madness, it's a bloodthirsty seagull that torments Ephraim relentlessly, but he's not allowed to kill it because it's bad luck to do so for those who work the sea. As the film goes on, I became less and less sure what was real and what was delusion, and at a certain point I stopped caring and just sat back and let it wash over my brain. The two men fight more and more as the film goes on. Dafoe screams like a banshee, and Pattinson basically learns to drink like a sailor for the first time, and becomes really violent sometimes. The entire experience of watching this movie is really immersive, and I don't use that word very often because I think it's overused, but it's almost like a horror film that makes your bones cold and the fear really sets in, because you really have no idea how things are going to end, or worse, if they're going to end. Their accents are so thick and exaggerated, it makes the entire experience even that much more otherworldly. it's almost a contest to see which of these two sea dogs I like more. Defoe is as committed to this part as I've ever seen him, but Pattinson just kind of vanishes into this role, especially with the physicality that looked like pure torture. There's a scene where he has to lug this barrel up the seemingly endless stairs that just hurts to watch. Pattinson's just like on this incredible roll right now with like High Life and Damsel and Good Time and Lost City of Z, and he's in this new Netflix film that just came out Friday called The King with Timothy Chalamet, and he's just shot the new Christopher Nolan movie, and of course he's got the Batman coming up. So I'm just so impressed with this guy right now. So the screenplay by Eggers and his brother Max is based on actual journals from the period and location, and then a bit of like Melville, and you can definitely feel it. It's sort of a hypnotic exercise that proves that Robert Eggers is the real deal as far as capturing a sense of time and place. He's not teaching us what it's like in whatever era he chooses to set his stories. He wants his audience to feel like his movies have just sent us into like some sort of time travel. Like he wants us to feel the salt on our clothes when it's over and smell it. And it's a wonderful thing. Even if you feel like you do need a shower afterwards. So yes, the Lighthouse is a terrific film.
Okay. Guys, hang on. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Take a quick break and we'll come back. We'll find out what Eric thought of the Lighthouse and I'll let you know what I thought of the Lighthouse. It's all coming up right here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio here till 5 a.m. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because we do that every Monday morning. And it's the Monday morning movie reviews, which we're doing right now. And then Eric's going to stick around. We'll talk box office as well. Eric, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Steve, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay, Eric, what did you think of The Lighthouse?
Well, through all of Steve's very elegant breakdown of what this movie is ultimately about, the two words that I keep coming back to are stop caring. But I'll get back to that in a second. Robert Eggers' The Witch, which I was not as big a fan of as most people were, primarily because I thought that the ending betrayed a lot of what that film was about. That's what I thought anyway. And watching The Lighthouse, the cinematography is so interesting to behold. Shooting 1:33 Academy ratio, like it's an old school, like some sort of unearthed, silent movie almost, with the exception that the soundtrack is cranked to like 15 throughout the film. Every sound effect, every bit of yelling that Willem Dafoe does, every fart, as Steve mentioned, everything is really dialed up here to an extent to, almost sort of keep you from drifting away from what is ultimately going on. Insanity can be interesting to people on film. This was not as interesting to me. The movie runs about 108 minutes, and it's tends to just kind of wear out. It wore out my welcome for the film, because it just seemed like they yell at each other. They have dinner. They drink. Robert Pattinson is forced to do work. He gets upset. They yell. They drink. They hug. They make up. They fight. There's violence. Robert Pattinson pleasures himself many times. There may or may not be a mermaid. And ultimately, if you've seen both movies, you can actually start to see sort of the parallels. And I found Eggers seemed to be almost tracing over bits in The Witch. Instead of a goat, we got a seagull. Instead of this female character kind of coming into her own sexuality. You have Robert Pattinson and the Little Mermaid statue. You know, whether the character in The Witch is seeing everything is in her own mind, or if it's really happening, is stuff that we get throughout The Lighthouse. And it's a lot of kind of repeat and rinse, although not so much rinsing. Like Steve said, you kind of want to take a shower by the end of this movie. And, you know, but I will say this, you know, even though I eventually kind of stopped caring, this is one of these movies that I am looking forward to taking a second look at. Is people, you know, who go to film festivals sometimes, when you're on the, you know, your sixth movie of the day and it's at night and it's The Lighthouse, you might tend to, you know, lose your focus a little bit, as I tended to a little bit more than halfway through this movie. But you know, I didn't fall asleep. I didn't do that. I remember that much. But I am looking forward to checking out a second time. But first impressions go, shrugged it off.
Oh, man. I think this is one of the best movies of the year. I loved it. I loved it. I think this guy is the real deal, man. I love The Witch. I love this. I like this guy's style. I thought obviously the cinematography is great, and it casts a real spell. For the entire, I was mesmerized by this movie all the way through, and it freaked me out. It was weird. It's funny. It's really funny. There's a lot of funny stuff in this movie. Both performances are great, but I gotta say, Robert Pattinson is unbelievable. He is so good in this movie. And as you said, Steve, he's on a roll. He's on a big roll, this guy. It's amazing to me that, like, if you were to say to me, you know, like 10 years ago when the Twilight movies came out, that those two actors, like him and Kristen Stewart, in like, you know, in 10 years would be like two of them, you know, two of the best actors on the planet. I'd say, shut up. You're crazy. But that's the case. I just think that there's a real sense of detail in the way that this guy makes movies. And he goes through these weird sort of fantastical moments, like in the last, like, the 20 minutes of the movie, it takes on a whole different tone. And it just gets really weird. Not gets weird. It's weird from the get go. But it just gets really off the rails in the last last like 20 minutes of the movie. I just was mesmerized by the whole thing. I thought it was great. I love the seagull. I thought the seagull was awesome. And the weirder the movie got, I just and just following what Pattinson does in this movie, like what he goes through as the character in this movie, it's just so insane. And the movie really does also subconsciously make a statement about drinking that I find pretty powerful, actually, because there's a lot of drinking in this movie. They do a lot of boozing in the film, and the effect that it has on both of the characters is pretty interesting and kind of fascinating. It adds a detail to it. It's just beautifully shot. It's a wonderful movie to look at. The cinematography is fantastic. I love the aspect ratio. It was weird to see this movie in Skokie near a mall with an audience that was like, what? You know, it was kind of like watching The Witch, because I saw The Witch there too at that same theater. And to say that the audience was puzzled there were a couple of walkouts during this movie, which I'm not surprised.
Oh, sure.
I will say this, though. This is insane. My parents loved it. Which I just did not expect. My parents loved it, and I find that real weird. I don't know, but this is not a conventional movie by any stretch of the imagination. And there's a lot of weird stuff in it. It's very R-rated, but I found it hypnotic, and I love the way this guy makes movies. I do, and I'm all about this one. I love this movie.
I will say, as much as I loved it, I don't think I'd try to convince anyone who didn't that they should give it a second chance.
No. I totally agree.
I get it.
I totally understand why people walked out. You know what I mean?
It's overwhelming. It really is.
I mean, especially the last 15 minutes of this movie is insane. And by that point, I was like, it's just, but I love this guy's, man. I love his movies. I really do. And I can't wait to see what he does next. And I thought it was great, but it's not for it's definitely not for everybody.
Nope.
That's for sure. All right. What do we got? A Terminator movie next week, right?
We got a Terminator movie. We got Edward Norton's The Detective. We got the Harriet Tubman movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Arctic Dogs.
And Arctic Dogs.
Oh,
yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Steve will be seeing Arctic Dogs.
That's right. Arctic Dogs.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We gotta give more money to Byron Allen.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
He doesn't have enough.
All right. Okay. Hey, Steve, we'll talk to you next week, buddy.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. All right. Eric, let's jump into the box office.
All right.
Once again, Joker, number one movie of the week. Almost $280 million worldwide. Or no, not me, just in America.
Yeah, just in America, it's going to pass $850 million any day now. $900 million is in its sights. And, you know, if it just keeps going, you know, $1 billion is going to be there for it. Right now it's looking, domestically, just alone, it's looking to be somewhere over $320
million. That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
I would have never expected that, especially after seeing it.
Yeah, exactly. Again, you know, people are kind of marveling, no pun intended, at the box office of this movie. And, you know, I tend to remind people, just like, but, you know, Suicide Squad sucked too, and everyone went and saw that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. All right, number two, Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, $18.5 million, $65 million total. This is doing much less money than the first one, right?
Far less. This movie is solely relying on its international dollars right now, and it had a pretty decent weekend over there, because worldwide the movie has grossed over $228 million, but $65 million in the U.S. and this movie has a chance of not even reaching $100 million when the first one did over $240 million. Just in the U.S., this is actually could be shaping up, depending on where the international numbers fall, as being one of the biggest bombs of the year.
Wow. Wow. Okay. You know, it's interesting because we talked about the timing of the release of this movie. And, you know, it's strange that they released it in October.
It's a mistake. I mean, I know they got Frozen 2 coming out basically in the Thanksgiving slot, so they couldn't do that. But it seemed like they could have released this November 1st or November 8th, gave it a couple weeks before Frozen 2, and, drawn that, you know, like, oh, it's holiday season, time to see movie crowd.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's nothing, I mean, what's this competition going to be? Arctic Dogs?
Yeah.
Or the John Cena Fireman movie?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell?
Yeah.
I mean, Disney gets a lot of things right, but they really blew this one.
Yeah. Okay. Number three, Addams Family, $11.7 million, $72 million total, almost $73 million. That's solid.
Yeah, it's doing a lot better than I thought it was going to do. I didn't know people really had an appetite to see an animated, you know, Addams Family movie. I guess those IHOP commercials really drew them in. but you know, this movie needs about $100 million worldwide to break even. It's about 84 total right now. So, you know, a couple more weeks, and this will be turn a small but, you know, respectable profit for United Artists.
Okay. Number four, Zombieland Double Tap, $11.6 million, $47 million total. That's much less than the first one, right?
Yeah, it's actually on par with what the first movie had made after 10 days, but the second weekend was far less than what the first film made. So this movie is not going to reach the $75 million that the original did. And again, the budget on this was a little bit higher. So this is another one that's also going to need somewhere over $100 million worldwide. First one didn't do great internationally. This one's not doing huge business internationally. So, you know, betting man would probably tell you that this is probably going to take us a little bit of a loss.
Okay. Number five, Countdown, $9 million. Nobody expected it to make any money anyway, did they?
No, and I think they'll be very happy with $9 million. You know, ultimately, this will probably take a loss. It only cost $6.5 million to make. The advertising budget was a little bit more, somewhere around like $15 to $20 million. So that's where they're going to end up probably losing their money. This movie might continue to draw up until Halloween Thursday night, even though Terminator will be opening that night as well.
Right.
But after that, I imagine this movie would be pretty forgotten. But, you know, I think, you know, $6.5 million movie and you make $9 million opening weekend, they'll take it.
Okay. Black and Blue comes in at number six with $8.3 million.
Yeah, another small budgeted movie. This one only cost $12 million. to make. So this one, you know, it might get, you know, between like 20 and 25 million. So this one's also going to be a small loser as well.
Okay. Number seven, wow, Gemini Man, $4 million, $43 Ooh. Million. Is this the biggest flop of Will Smith's career?
I'd have to check all time of his career. I can't think of one that would measure as badly as this one. I mean, he's had, you know, movies that didn't gross $100 million before, many of them actually, but yeah. none with this sort of scale
yeah.
to them. And yeah, I mean, the in Maleficent, Mistress of Evil can at least take some solace that it's not going to be as big a bomb as Gemini Man is.
Right. And then The Lighthouse, $3 million. Nobody expected that to make a ton of money anyway, right?
No, but that's a very solid number. You remember A24, you know, the first wide release they ever put out was The Witch. They opened that into over 2,000 theaters on opening weekend, and you know it grossed $8 million and ultimately grossed over 25. What if they would have platformed that thing? It probably, you know, might not have even made 10, maybe yeah. not even half that.
Yeah.
But this one, you know, they got it out into five. It's only in five, like 580 some theaters right now. Expanded up from 8 last week.
Right.
So getting into the top 10 at $3 million, you know, I can't imagine word of mouth can be that
right,
great
right.
on it, like as we mentioned. But you know, they're paying for this movie, so I think that they're very happy to see this movie represented in the top 10.
All right, well, didn't expect that. So what are we looking at numbers-wise for Terminator? Is it just going to be nuts?
I don't know if it's going to be nuts or not. I mean, are people really that? I mean, we've had a lot of bad Terminator movies.
Yes, we have.
Since, you know, and you and I think, are on the positive side of Terminator 3.
I am, yes.
Even. Yeah. And people like to bunch that in with the bad ones that came afterwards. So even if people are thinking that we haven't had a good Terminator movie since 1991, I mean, the return of Schwarzenegger and Hamilton will be a draw. So I'm kind of thinking kind of low 40s
okay.
for this. Yeah.
All right.
But it'll be number one next weekend.
Yes, it will. There's no question about that. All right, Eric, thanks, man.
Sure thing.
All right, we'll talk to you next week. Eric Childress does the box office with us. He writes a report on the box office as well every week. And there it is. And we'll do the Monday morning movie reviews again next week. All right, let's take a quick break here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here. It's Monday morning. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. And also the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom right here on 720 WGN. So as we reviewed the Lighthouse during the movie reviews, we mentioned that it was shot in black and white. So we are going to talk about some great modern movies that were made in black and white. So there's a there you know, these go back. This is like post 1970 is what we're talking about. You know, we've had some beautiful black and white movies over the past few years, including The Lighthouse, which is just a beautifully shot movie. It looks fantastic in black and white. I love black and white.
Oh, it's the best.
I love it. And I know that it's, you know, kids nowadays, they don't like the black and white. They're immediately, you know, turned off by it. But I just think black and white is beautiful. I do.
Well, yeah. And if you're willing to take the time to shoot in black and white, I mean, it means something.
Yeah. Color motion pictures became the norm by the mid-50s, but that doesn't mean black and white films are no longer being made. In fact, the black and white horror movie The Lighthouse just hit theaters, making it one of many modern films made in black and white for financial, artistic, or setting-related reasons over the last few decades. Considering only live-action films presented entirely or almost entirely without color, released after 1970, and here are 25 of the best modern movies made in black and white. All right. I'm really the first one that they mention here, because these are in chronological order from earliest to most recent. The first one they mention is Multiple Maniacs. Multiple Maniacs only made about $33,000 at the box office, but that's nearly six times what John Waters spent making this 1970 black comedy horror film. The film's director, producer, screenwriter, editor, cinematographer, and composer subsequently made numerous movies, that have received more attention than Multiple Maniacs, but to this day, this is still his best reviewed. Is that right? Multiple Maniacs can't be his best reviewed movie.
Well, I'm trying to think of what the other option. Pink Flamingos, probably not.
No, Hairspray, probably.
Oh, yeah.
My guess would be Hairspray.
Yeah.
As the best reviewed of all of his movies. I like Serial Mom. I love that movie. I think Kathleen Turner is fantastic in that movie. But yeah, Multiple Maniacs, it's been a long time since I've seen that one. I'm just trying to think of some of the other John Waters movies.
You got Polyester.
Yeah, Polyester. That was the one that was in, Polyester was the one that was in Smell-O-Vision or Odorama. Odorama. I still have my card. Because when you went to go see Polyester, it was in Odorama, and what they gave you was a card, like a cardboard card, and with different circles on it that were numbered, like one through 15 or something. And so what happened is that when a number flashes on the screen, you were supposed to scratch and sniff that number so you can smell what was happening in the. You know, in the movie. So I still got my scratch and sniff card from Polyester. And with this is John Waters being John Waters, you know, like I said, at one point, they have a gas leak in the house. And so you scratch and sniff and it smells like a gas leak. But then there was a scene where Divine is in a room with a bunch of roses and the number flashes, and as you scratch and you're about to sniff, she farts. And then that's what you smell. And of course I expect that from John Waters. I would be disappointed if he made a movie in Odorama and didn't have a fart joke in it.
Of course. He's the king of poor taste.
I didn't by the way, I did not expect fart jokes in The Lighthouse.
No.
That was not something I expected. They
jump into it almost immediately.
Yeah. I was like, all right.
I guess he just had to break the tension somehow because it starts off super ominous.
Oh, it does. Well, the whole thing is ominous.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, there's a few fart jokes in there. I didn't expect that. but so, yeah, Multiple Maniacs was in black and white. Paper Moon was in black and white. In addition to being shot in black and white to reflect its 1930s setting, Peter Bogdanovich's Paper Moon is most notable for featuring the father-daughter protagonist duo played by Ryan O'Neill and his real-life daughter, Tatum. She was only 9 years old in 1973 when it was filmed, and the following year she became the youngest person to ever win a competitive Oscar upon nabbing the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress at 10. Paper Moon earned two additional nods at the event, Best Sound and Best Adapted Screenplay by Alvin Sargent. Yeah, and then they followed it up with Nickelodeon, which wasn't as good. Paper Moon's better than Nickelodeon. And Tatum O'Neill's terrific in that movie. And have you ever seen the footage of her at the awards?
I have not seen the footage of her at the awards.
She wore a tux.
Nice.
Yeah.
The only reason I even became aware of Paper Moon was, I can't remember what I was watching, but they were talking about how it was a big deal that in Paper Moon there's a 9-year-old smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the only thing I knew about it. I was like, okay, this is that movie where a 9-year-old smokes cigarettes, and it's a great movie.
It's a terrific movie. But, I mean, you know, even as uncomfortable as that is, you know, 9-year-old smoking cigarettes, that was 1973, you know, and it was,
And then a movie taking place in the 30s,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But, I mean, in the 70s, everybody smoked.
Sure.
There's ashtrays in everybody's house.
You told me that your dad used to send you to the corner store or whatever.
Yeah.
Just with a note.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was a real thing. You can go get a couple of packs of cigarettes at the corner store with a note from the parents. No, that was a thing in the 70s. It was fine.
Well, it makes me think of Dazed and Confused.
Yeah.
Probably just go in with a note.
Yeah. You're 18, right? man. You know, one of my favorite parts of that moment where Mitch goes into the liquor store to get a sixer. When he's coming out and they're like, what's in the bag? A sixer. My favorite, though, is as he walks in. Do you remember what's happening as he walks in?
Oh, man. Isn't the clerk is, like, selling... He's selling a woman's, like, a bunch of... I think she's selling her booze and cigarettes.
She's pregnant.
She's pregnant, yeah.
She's visibly, like, 9 months pregnant. She's smoking, and she's getting booze. And, you know, so that's funny enough. And then at the end when she's about to leave, he goes, I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah. Make sure you eat a green thing every day. It's important for a young mother to eat something green.
Eat something green every day. See you tomorrow.
It's depressing, but it's just too funny.
Oh, it's hilarious. It's hilarious. Okay, Lenny. That was shot in black and white, which was the story of Lenny Bruce. Controversial comedian Lenny Bruce died way too young at the age of 40 in 1966. But his life was brought to the big screen 8 years later by now iconic actor Dustin Hoffman, starring in the Bob Fosse-directed biopic Lenny. Based on the Julian Barry play of the same name, Hoffman turned out an Academy Award-nominated performance alongside Valerie Perrine, who also earned a nomination. In all, Lenny earned 6 Oscar nods, including Best Picture and Director, but it failed to win any. So, good movie, though.
I enjoyed it.
Yep. All right, let's break here. We got the news coming up right after this.
Monday's a mess. You got the Obamas in town. You got President Trump in town.
Protesters will be out. Roads will be closed.
Throw Ed Obradovich into all of that.
Oh, no.
It's the Rokan Show.
With Anna DeVlantis.
This afternoon at 3. WGN.
All righty, then. We're going to come back and talk about black and white movies. If you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. One of your favorite modern-day black and white movies. Hey, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5. I am here every weekday morning from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich follows at 5 with the opening bell, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive right here on WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you would like to join us. 312-981-7200. We're talking about modern-day black-and-white movies. This new film called The Lighthouse, which is a really terrific movie. Not for everybody. It is not for everybody. But I thought it was great. And seriously, Tom, what kind of a role is Pattinson on right now?
I have no idea. He has become my favorite actor of his generation.
Is that nuts or what? I mean, and the same thing with Kristen Stewart. Swear to God, man.
Mm-hmm.
Back when those stupid Twilight movies came out, I was like, who are these people? And she's like one of the best actresses on the planet now, and he is killing it. Never would have expected those two people from the Twilight movies to be considered like two of the best actors ever, but they are. Anyway, The Lighthouse is in black and white, and I wish there were more movies that were shot in black and white. I love black and white movies. I like the fact that filmmakers today will take a risk every once in a while and make a black and white movie. Now, you know, I guess it's kind of like box office. It's not good for the box office to shoot a movie in black and white, because I think younger audiences, and I don't want to, you know, make this sound like a cliche or something, but I think younger audiences are turned off by black and white, which I don't quite understand, because, you know, black and white movies are just beautiful. And this movie, this Lighthouse, is just a gorgeous-looking movie. It's beautiful. And the black-and-white photography is fantastic. So we're talking about modern-day black-and-white movies. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Here's Dave on WGN. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Nick. Would a couple from the mid-60s be part of this conversation?
There were still a lot of black-and-white movies made in the 60s, but that's when it really started to shift. That's when color really started.
Because I can think of one that they had a really tough time deciding if they wanted to go in color or black and white, and that's Burt Lancaster in The Train. They were originally going to film it in color, but they decided to go for black and white. Do you know that one?
I do know that one, yes.
Okay, and another one from about the same year of Rod Steiger in The Pawnbroker.
Oh, yeah, that's a real happy movie.
Yeah.
Jeez. Yeah.
Don't forget A Hard Day's Night, everyone's favorite black and white movie.
There you go. All right, thanks, Dave.
Thanks.
Take care. Okay. All right. We got to mention Young Frankenstein. Just so the parody of the satire of that is just so it captures the look beautifully. And man, that movie's funny. Yeah, and again, I just, you know, Mel Brooks released Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein same year.
That just blows my mind.
No, it's insane.
It's shocking.
Two of the greatest movie comedies of all time in one year. It's nuts.
And it's not only that, it's one of the most quotable movies of all time because
yeah,
there's just so many lines that you can use.
Well,
in
I mean, my favorite moment in Young Frankenstein is sedative. That's my favorite. It's my favorite moment in the whole movie. Mel Brooks wanted to reproduce the atmosphere of early monster flicks, so he chose to shoot 1974's Young Frankenstein in black and white. The hilarious horror movie was an instant hit and raked in $86 million against a budget of less than $3 million, and it is frequently named among the funniest films ever made. Praised for its script penned by Brooks and Gene Wilder, Young Frankenstein also starred Wilder at his best, alongside acclaimed performances by Peter Boyle, Marty Feldman, Cloris Leachman, and Terry Garr. Yeah. Legendary. Just legendary. Mark the Breadman says, my two votes for recent black and white movies would be Young Frankenstein and the black and chrome version of Fury Road. Did you ever see the black and chrome version of Fury Road?
I did, and I think it's really cool. I think it's an awesome like extra to have on like the DVD Blu-ray. But to me, Fury Road is just so bracingly colorful that I kind of felt like I was missing something watching the black and white version. But it is very cool.
It was cool. It was
very
cool. I mean, look, it's one of the greatest movies ever made, and I can watch it in any condition. I don't care. So I went to the Music Box to see the black and chrome, and it was cool. You know, I enjoyed it. It was great. But yeah, I prefer the color. I know George Miller wanted to shoot it in black and white.
Yeah, which is so strange because it just seems like he's like, well, they're not going to let me shoot it in black and white. I'm just going to go the complete other direction, just saturate it with color.
Yeah.
I will say one movie that came out fairly recently that I think the black and white version is much better is Logan. Logan Noir is very cool.
Yeah.
And I think it works really, really well.
Another example is The Mist.
Oh, it's so good in black and white.
It's great in black and white. And there's another one. Darabont wanted to film that in black and white.
Yeah.
And the studio was like, no. But the version that you can see, you can watch it in black and white. It's part of the DVD Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And I prefer it in black and white. Let's see. 630 area code says, the two that come to mind couldn't be more opposite. Clerks and Schindler's List. Yeah, that is pretty much as opposite as you can possibly get. Let's see. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going?
All right.
Okay, this is... I know there's a lot of modern-day black and white movies, but this is the one that I usually remember that pops up in my head. And I like they were trying to go back to the classic movies in the 20s. This one came out in the 80s. Now, of course, the star directed this. It was Under the Cherry Moon by Prince.
Oh, yeah. That was shot in black and white. Hated that movie. Loved the music, but I hated the movie. But, yeah, shot in black and white. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
All right, yeah, Under the Cherry Moon. The terrible movie. Terrible. But the soundtrack, I mean, obviously the music is great because it's Prince. Let's see. Here's Harold on WGN. Go ahead, Harold.
Hey, Nick. How you doing?
All right.
Well, there's a couple of obvious ones I could pick, but I'm not going to take away from anybody else. So let some of the other people pick some of those, you know, major ones. But Steve Martin, maybe the funniest movie he's done is The Jerk, but my favorite movie by him is Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
Yeah, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, shot in black and white, consists of a bunch of clips from older movies.
And they shot it where he's when they put him in a scene, when they put Steve Martin in a scene and he's talking to Humphrey Bogart or he's talking to Kirk Douglas, it appears as if he's in the same scene, because without the benefit of CGI, I believe they built sets that were identical to the scenes that were shot, it had been shot 30 or 40 years earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. And lighting set up the same. And it appeared when they cut to Martin and then cut back to Bogart, it appeared he was in the same role.
Yeah. No, it was a very clever movie. And they used the clips very well. Carl Reiner directed that one, as Carl Reiner directed many of the original Steve Martin movies. He directed The Jerk. He directed Dead Man Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with Two Brains.
That one's my favorite, The Man with Two Brains.
Man with Two Brains is hilarious.
Somebody get that cat out of here.
Oh, man. Harold, thanks, man. Yeah, that this is, you know, but I got to say, you know, as a maniac SNL fan, and by the way, Chance the Rapper should host every week.
Yeah, he really elevated it.
Oh, my God.
He did a very good job.
He was, the performances were great. He was hilarious. And he had the Chicago Teachers Union sweatshirt on. You know, I love the guy. And he's funny. He's really funny. And he did a great job the second time hosting, and he killed it again. Yeah. But anyway, but being the maniac Saturday Night Live fan that I am, at that time period, you know, Steve Martin was on every other week. A lot of people get confused. They think Steve Martin was actually a cast member because he was on so many times.
Could have fooled me.
But not a cast member. He hosted many times. He appeared many times, obviously. And then he had recurring characters that he would play on SNL, like the wild and crazy guys. But he was not a host. He was not an actual star of the show. He wasn't a cast member. He was just a host. But he appeared so many times, you know, that people thought he was part of it. Now, being the maniac SNL fan that I was and still am, obviously, I was excited. I was so excited that, and I saw Steve Martin in concert. I saw him twice in concert, he played the amphitheater. He sold out the amphitheater. He's a stand-up comedian. So anyway. I was, you know, obviously very excited when The Jerk came out, and I you know, because it was his first, you know, the first thing, and I think that movie's hilarious. I just he hates these cans.
What's wrong with these cans?
Stay away from the cans. There are snails on her plate. That movie is hilarious. It is hilarious. Yeah, so we're talking about black and white. Let's see. Joliet Mike says, my favorite black and white movie is Clerks. It was very cheaply made for only about $27,000. One of the other strokes of genius with that movie, with Clerks, is, you know, they shot it at a real store.
The one that Kevin worked at.
Yeah. And so what's genius about it is that the shades, the gates that cover the window?
Yeah.
All right, they're stuck because somebody's put gum in the lock. He can't open them. And then he puts out the sign that says, I assure you we are open, you know, on the grates. Well, they did that on purpose because they shot mostly at night. So they didn't want to have to worry about sunlight outside. So he just like, all right, let's just write in that the gates are stuck, so that way we can shoot at 2 o'clock in the morning and not worry about having anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I always thought that was pretty clever.
And I kind of wish that he had shot the other, like Clerks 2 in black and white, just to keep it consistent. But it's still,
I love Clerks 2.
Clerks 2 is funny as
it's
hell.
It's hilarious.
Movies.
It's hilarious. 630 area code says, I'm not sure if Raging Bull would count. Yeah, of course it counts. It was almost 85% in black and white. I just love that film, and I'm looking forward to seeing The Irishman. Who's not looking forward to seeing The Irishman? All 3 hours and 36 minutes of it.
I don't think, I told Lauren about it. She's like, I don't think I can do it. And I was like, what do you mean you can't do it?
It's easy.
It's De Niro.
Pacino. Pesci.
She says to me, we're going to watch it in 2 days. I was like, no, we're not. You can watch it in 2 days. Over the course.
I'm going to watch it in 3 hours and 30 minutes. Yeah, exactly. That's how I'm going to watch it.
Give me a popcorn.
So, all right, let's see. Here's John on WGN. Hi, John.
Yes, I thought of the Coen brothers, The Man Who Wasn't There, their little film noir thing with Billy Bob Thornton.
Yeah. Yeah, that was beautifully shot. I'm trying to remember who the cinematographer was for that. I think it's the same guy who shoots a lot of their movies. I always forget who it is. John, thanks for the call. Why don't we take a quick break? When we come back, we got more modern-day black and white movies, and I think more movies should be shot in black and white. And I'm happy that that the Lighthouse is in black and white. Very, very cool. Okay, let's take a quick break, and more after this on WGN. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. And we're talking about modern-day black and white movies. What are some of your favorites? The new movie, The Lighthouse, is shot in beautiful black and white. And we're talking about some of the more modern ones. All right, next one that they mentioned here in the article is Eraserhead. Which is still my favorite David Lynch movie.
I'll always go Blue Velvet.
Yeah, I mean, but
Eraserhead's off.
Eraserhead, it's still my favorite. And I mean, obviously, I love Blue Velvet and I love Wild at Heart. I love everything the guy does. Inland Empire. And the reboot of Twin Peaks, Episode 8. Man. Most of that was shot in black and white, that episode.
He's got away with black and white.
Just the weirdest thing. I remember sitting on my couch just going, I can't imagine how Showtime just went, yeah, go ahead, do that.
I guarantee you there was a Showtime exec just sitting in his office waiting to see if he was going to lose his job the next day.
That episode in particular, the whole series was crazy. The whole reboot of Twin Peaks was absolutely nuts, in a great way. But that episode is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. It is absolutely the craziest thing that's ever been on TV. I mean, without question. I watched it twice. Like, as soon as it was over, I was like, well, I got to watch that again. Because that was the most insane thing I've ever seen. I used to, every Monday morning when I get home from work, man, that was the first thing I did. Watch last night's Twin Peaks. I couldn't believe what I was watching, man. I remember I texted Eric. I'm like, have you seen episode 8 of Twin Peaks? David Lynch's feature-length directorial debut was the 1977 surreal horror film Eraserhead, a movie he also wrote, produced, scored, and edited. We don't have nearly enough real estate to delve into the far-out plot centering around Henry Spencer, played by Jack Nance, which was initially greeted with a lukewarm reception by critics, but Eraserhead has since found favor and is now regarded as a disturbing yet darkly funny cult classic. In addition to selection to the National Film Registry in 2004, Eraserhead was also said to be Stanley Kubrick's favorite film.
You know, they really got to show that movie in, like, sex ed classes, because everybody's worried about getting kids, you know, no, we don't want teen pregnancy. You watch that movie once, you'll never want to have a child again.
That's true. True. Yeah, I remember the first time I saw it. You know, I was like 13. And I was like, what the hell is this? Even by my standards, because I saw a lot of weird stuff when I was a kid. I was exposed to a lot of weird stuff, saw a lot of R-rated movies, a lot of horror movies and stuff. But even, you know, even then, I was like, what is happening here? here's Rich on WGN. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Nick. Good morning. The one movie that came to my mind that just it wouldn't ever have gotten the traction that it does have now, because it was in black and white, was The Last Picture Show.
Oh, it's a great movie.
If it was in color, not the same.
Yeah. And the sequel was in color, but that didn't work out too well.
Right.
But that original one, Last Picture Show. The great Jeff Bridges, man. Okay, thanks, Rich.
You bet.
Right. Yeah, The Last Picture Show. Peter Bogdanovich. He liked to shoot in black and white.
He was one of those guys.
Yeah. Manhattan, Woody Allen. Woody Allen said his memories of his childhood in New York City are in black and white, which is why he chose to eschew color when shooting the 1979 romantic comedy Manhattan. The cast of Allen, Diane Keaton, Mariel Hemingway, Michael Murphy, and Meryl Streep turned out strong performances, and the film ended up nabbing 2 Oscar nods in addition to $40 million at the box office. And I think widely considered by most people to be his best movie. I'm not a Woody Allen guy pretty much at all. not a Woody Allen fan for the most part. I like Manhattan. I like Annie Hall. And that might be it. No, some of the earlier, funnier stuff that he did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bananas. That's a funny movie. But, I know he's so many of the stuff that is, like, critically acclaimed. Crimes and Misdemeanors is a movie I can't stand. I hate that movie. And I dislike most of Woody Allen's movies.
Not even Hannah and Her Sisters?
No.
Really?
Nope.
He's a very specific type of taste. You know?
I'll tell you which one I... There are a few that stand out for me that I liked, actually. Like, I like Blue Jasmine a lot. And that mostly has to do with how good Cate Blanchett is in it.
Yeah, she's amazing.
And how great Dice is. Dice is awesome in that movie.
I hate Dice, and I still had to give a tip of the cap to that. I cannot stand Andrew Dice Clay.
The first episode of Vinyl, he's phenomenal in that. Phenomenal. I'm a big fan of Andrew Dice Clay. Big fan. Ford Fairlane, rules. Rennie Harlan, man.
You know what the first Woody Allen movie I ever saw was? I couldn't have been more than 7 years old, and on the plane, I was on an international flight, and they had The Curse of the Jade Scorpion.
Oh, God.
I was watching it. I was like, what the hell is this?
That's a terrible movie. Yeah. And the other thing about it is that, like, he would release 2 movies a year.
It was wild. Yeah.
You know? I don't know if I'm sure he's got another. What was his last movie?
Oh, my God. Well, now he was going to do the whole thing for Amazon, and then it got kind of messed up. I don't know.
I don't even remember.
I think he might have gotten it released. He did something with Miley Cyrus. It was a series.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't think anybody watched it because they're done with them.
Mike from Novak Construction says, black and white movie would be Purple Rose of Cairo. Also Broadway Danny Rose, both by Woody Allen. Well, Purple Rose of Cairo wasn't all in black and white, was it?
Is that the one where...
That's where Jeff Daniels comes off the screen.
Yeah. I think maybe portions of it were in black and white. I think I've seen it one time on TV.
Broadway Danny Rose was all in black and white. How about Manhattan? Another one, yep. Not sure if you count Pleasantville. Well, part of it is shot in black and white. I like that movie.
No, it's great.
765 area code says the black and white version of The Mist is better and scarier than the color version. I think we all agree on that.
To me, it's the same thing. It's the same difference between watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 1956 and Invasion of the Body Snatchers from 78?
78.
I think they both have a different feel, and it's literally just because of the color palette.
You know, here's the thing about that, and I've mentioned this before. Body Snatchers, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, is the only movies that I like all 4 versions of. All 4 versions are good. The 57 version, the Don Siegel version is great. The Philip Kaufman version is phenomenal from 78. Abel Ferrara's version is fantastic from 93. God, Meg Tilly is so scary in that movie. Where are you going to go? Where are you going to run? And then the version with Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman.
That's the only one I can't get on board with. I'm sorry.
It's clearly the weakest of the 4.
Very much so.
And there was a lot of issues about the making of that movie.
Well, yeah, didn't the Wachowskis had to like write and do a bunch of scenes for them?
Yeah, and then the studio took it and recut it, and it didn't come out when it was supposed to come out. But even in that regard, I actually think it's pretty solid. But of all of them, it's hard to pick. But I think the 78 version is my favorite.
I think it is pound for pound the best, with Don Siegel's just very, very little bit behind.
I think that ending is amazing.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Black and white movies is what we're talking about. Modern day black and white movies in honor of The Lighthouse, which is out right now. All right. The news is coming up right after we break here. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and the great Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. In honor of the new movie, The Lighthouse, which is shot in beautiful black and white, we were talking about modern-day black and white movies and what are the best ones, which ones are great, and hoping that more filmmakers actually do some black and white, make some more black and white movies. 314 area code says, when I think of modern black and white films, I think of The Artist, which was also a silent movie. That movie hasn't aged well.
Yeah, definitely didn't have a ton of staying power.
No. And it won Best Picture that year. And didn't the dude win Best Actor, too, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What's it? God, what was his name?
I can't remember his name.
I feel terrible. It's not Depardieu.
No.
That's the crazy drunk guy.
Yeah, Depardieu is like...
That's it, Depardieu.
He's like 350 pounds. He's a big dude. But yeah, so I can't remember what that guy's name was, but I remember the dog. That's the only thing that I remember from the movie.
Oh, everybody was crazy. Wasn't it like a Jack Russell Terrier or something like that?
Yeah.
Jean Dujardin.
That's it.
That's it.
Yeah, and he did win Best Actor that year.
He's a good actor, too.
No, he is. Yeah, and he's good in the movie.
Yeah.
I just haven't seen that one. That's one of those movies that I just have not revisited. I mean, it was all the rage when it came out.
Oh, yeah. Totally.
How about The Elephant Man?
Another David Lynch.
Another Ouch. David Lynch.
I am a man.
I love that movie.
It's a remarkable performance by all.
Oh, my God. Yeah. David Lynch checks back in just 3 years after Eraserhead with this acclaimed 1980 biopic, The Elephant Man, based on the life of a severely deformed Englishman, Joseph Merrick. The drama starred John Hurt, Anthony Hopkins, and Anne Bancroft. It earned 8 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor for Hurt, and Best Adapted Screenplay. The elaborate prosthesis in The Elephant Man were so highly praised that the lack of recognition at the Oscars led to the Academy creating a new category the following year, Best Makeup. Wow, it really took until 1980 for them to...
Mm-hmm.
Wow, I guess I just forgot that it took till 1980... to get a Best Makeup Award?
Yeah. Took till 2001 to get Best Animated Feature.
Yeah.
So, and which blows my mind.
Yeah.
I'm just, how did you just not have that?
Raging Bull, shot in beautiful black and white. Several other boxing films were being released around the time of Raging Bull, so Martin Scorsese convinced the studio to let him do the sports biopic in black and white to separate it from the pack. The director also knew his audiences... had grown up watching boxing matches televised in black and white and wished to match these memories. Those distinctions, as well as strong performances by Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and Kathy Moriarty, propelled Jake LaMotta's life story to 8 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture and Best Director, and wins for Best Actor and Best Editing. So, you know, Scorsese did not win Best Director that year.
Which is insanity.
Robert Redford did. And look, I like Ordinary People.
Sure.
Okay. I do. In fact, I love Ordinary People. But it's not Raging Bull.
Potentially the best movie of the decade.
And then Scorsese in 1990 lost Best Director to another actor, Kevin Costner. It's Goodfellas. We're talking about Goodfellas. He lost Best Director to Kevin Costner, who made Dances with Wolves.
When's the last time someone sat down and watched Dances with Wolves?
Never.
Never.
I've only seen it once. I don't like it. I mean, I've only seen it the one time.
Meanwhile, people have like rooms dedicated to Goodfellas.
I mean, Goodfellas is a classic. Is a true classic. I've seen Goodfellas 9,000 times. You know, the thing about Raging Bull, I love Raging Bull. I love it. There is a lot of funny stuff in Raging Bull.
Super funny.
People forget that all the time. But there's the stuff between him and Pesci is hilarious. Like the byplay between him and Pesci.
When he calls him on the phone?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And the whole punch me, I want you to punch me as hard as you can, whole thing.
Yeah.
You take the baby, go in the other room. Take the baby, go in the other room. People forget just how funny that movie is, man. There's a lot of funny stuff in Raging Bull. I mean, it's obviously serious, and it's the guy in Jake LaMotta was a lunatic who taught people, you know, who treated people poorly, especially women, especially his wife. But there's a lot of humor in that movie. It cracks me up every time I watch it. There's always at least four or five scenes in that movie that just kill me.
When it comes to shooting inside the ring, I don't think anybody shot a boxing scenes that well until probably Creed.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. 708 area code says, you talk about Fury Road. Friday the 13th, 6, Jason Lives was shot for black and white because the director was a fan of classic monster movies. How about that for Halloween? I don't remember. Was the Friday the 13th movie was in black and white?
No, I think they might have just shot, like, wanted to shoot it in black and white. I don't...
You can't make a Friday the 13th movie and not have red. You know, you have to have the color red in a Friday the 13th movie. Because that's the color of blood. 218 area code says, what happened to Kevin Smith's career? After Zach and Miri Make a Porno flopped, he kind of rode off into the sunset, releasing bad horror movies every 5 years. He's still working.
Well, yeah, he just got Jay and Silent Bob a reboot.
Yeah.
He's playing right now. You can check it out.
It says, okay, Red State was good, but where's the next Chasing Amy or Dogma? I can't stand Dogma. I can't stand that movie. And I really am a fan of Kevin Smith, but I can't stand that movie. And I was really looking forward to it. Chasing Amy is still my favorite Kevin Smith movie. I think it's the best movie he's ever made. And I loved Red State. Michael Parks, man.
Off the chain. No, I mean, he's kind of laid back, and he's dabbling in movies still, but it seems like he makes most of his money being a podcaster, honestly. He has his whole podcast.
Oh,
network,
sure.
And that's just what he does.
Yeah. Zach and Miri Make a Porno. I remember liking that movie.
I think it's great. I think it's a really funny movie.
I've only seen it. I think I've only seen it the one time, but I remember liking it. That's Elizabeth Banks, right?
Yeah, it's
and
Seth Rogen.
Seth Rogen, yeah.
Seth Rogen, Elizabeth Banks. It's pretty juvenile, but super funny, if you ask me.
479 area code says, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? That's a lovely movie to watch with your wife.
That's date night.
Oh, yeah, that's a date movie right there. Jim Jarmusch, Stranger Than Paradise, 773 area code. Yeah, Dead Man. Speaking of Jim Jarmusch. One of my favorite movies ever. It's my favorite Jim Jarmusch movie, and Neil Young's score is unbelievable. That is such a great movie. Beautiful black and white. 312 area code says, no one has mentioned Sin City or Schindler's List. Sin City was great, but not the sequel. Well, Sin City's not really black and white.
Yeah, it's digitally done that way.
Yeah.
But I guess it kind of it counts.
I liked Sin City. I thought the first Sin City was good. The second one was terrible.
Yeah, I think some of Sin City hasn't aged super well, but it's still pretty. It's still. Really
I will
well
say
done.
It's been a while since I've seen it.
Yeah, I own it. I'll pop it in every once in a while. There's some of it that just doesn't. The visual effects don't hold up as well as they did back in 2005.
Yeah,
but it's still interesting. Still pretty good.
They mentioned Stranger Than Paradise in the article here. It says fans of Jim Jarmusch would be incensed if we didn't include Dead Man or Coffee and Cigarettes or at least one of the director's numerous black and white films to the list. However, the highest rated film, at least according to Rotten Tomatoes, is his 1984 breakthrough comedy Stranger Than Paradise. In what would become Jarmusch's signature style, the film is loaded with long takes but was well received by critics and audiences alike and ended up becoming one of the most influential indie movies of the 80s. Eventually earning a spot in the National Film Registry. I don't care what anybody says. His zombie movie was good. I don't care.
Dead Don't Die?
Yeah. Everybody hates it.
I enjoyed it.
I thought it was great. Now here's one of the most beautiful movies ever made. Mentioned Wings of Desire. Truly one of the most beautiful films ever made. Wim Wenders. Wings of Desire won some 18 awards at various festivals, including Best Director honors at both Cannes and the European Film Festival for German filmmaker Wim Wenders, who also co-produced the romantic fantasy film. It's a story of an angel who chooses to become mortal to experience life as a human. Sounds familiar. It's because Wings of Desire was later remade as the 1998 Nicolas Cage, Meg Ryan film City of Angels. which I actually like. I thought it was a bad idea to try and remake Wings of Desire, because Wings of Desire is like a perfect movie. But City of Angels was entertaining. It was entertaining. And that damn Goo Goo Dolls song that's in there. Yeah. So, what do you guys think? 312-981-7200. We're talking about black and white movies, and we are going to get to the topic of guilty pleasure movies. What movies fall into that category, guilty pleasure? So we'll wrap up the black and white talk, and then after the 4 o'clock news, we'll jump into guilty pleasure movies. Welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the Skyline studio. And here until 5 a.m., Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and also the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on WGN. All right. In honor of the release of the new film, The Lighthouse, which was shot in gorgeous black and white, we are talking about modern-day black and white movies. Which ones do you guys like? And if you want to talk to us or text us, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Mentioned again in the article, of course, is Schindler's List, released in 1993, but set at the time of World War II. Schindler's List was almost exclusively filmed in black and white because director Steven Spielberg wanted to give the footage a documentary feel. The notable exception to this lack of color was one little girl in the Krakow ghetto shown wearing a bright red coat among an otherwise dismal backdrop. That little girl was later shown among bodies of the deceased, only recognized because of her red coat. Schindler's List earned a dozen Academy Award nominations and won 7. Best Picture, Director, Adapted Screenplay, Original Score, Film Editing, Cinematography, and Art Direction. Actors Liam Neeson and Ralph Fiennes received Oscar nods for their performances in the historical drama, which earned over $322 million worldwide. And of course, we have Clerks from 1994. I'm not even supposed to be here today, is the repeated lament of reluctant convenience store clerk Dante Hicks, played by Brian O'Halloran, in the 1994 indie comedy Clerks. For what it's worth, we're certainly glad O'Halloran showed up to work on director Kevin Smith's debut film along fellow unknown actors Jeff Anderson, Marilyn Gilotti, Laura Spoonauer, Jason Mewes, and Smith himself. Smith had to max out numerous credit cards and sell part of his comic book collection to fund the film, which reportedly cost $27,575 to be shot in black and white to cut costs, but it ended up earning more than $3 million at the box office and has since become a cult classic, introducing the characters of Jay and Silent Bob. All right. Here's Dan on WGN. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
Morning.
Hey, that movie, did you ever see it, Last Night at the Alamo?
Last Night at the Alamo, no.
Or Last Night of the Alamo. It's made in 83 or 84, but it's done in black and white about a bar in Houston, Texas. It's the last night of the bar that's open.
Oh, all right.
And everything takes place, all the, you know, they're all the characters that are in the bar. Pick it up. I've seen it on IFC.
Ah. All right, I'll have to look for it.
Yeah, it's pretty amusing. Funny story, too, okay. The movie.
All right, Dan, thanks, man. Take care. You can go. Ed Wood. God, I love that movie. Ed Wood was a critical success and earned 2 Academy Awards, but it was a failure at the box office, bringing in less than $6 million against a budget of $18 million. We still think that it's a net win for the biopic that stars Johnny Depp, Martin Landau, Sarah Jessica Parker, Patricia Arquette, Lisa Marie, Jeffrey Jones, and Bill Murray. Columbia actually dropped the film early in production over director Tim Burton's decision to shoot it in black and white, and Ed Wood was instead picked up by Disney and Touchstone Pictures. I don't remember it bombing. I don't know why. Because I like it so much? That's probably that's probably what it is.
Selective memory.
Following. Way before Inception, Interstellar, and The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan made his directorial debut with the 69-minute-long Following. Shot for as little as possible, Nolan filmed the crime drama in black and white on 16mm stock and managed to keep the budget tight, $6,000. $6,000, wow. Following wasn't shown in many theaters, but it did the festival circuit, and the screenings were constantly followed by positive reviews. And it got a re-release after Memento. When Memento came out, people were like, who's this guy? I know I felt that way. When I saw Memento, I was like, whoa!
Smart guy.
Yeah.
Spent a little bit of time in Evanston. I think his mom was from Evanston.
Mm. His mom?
Yeah, one of his parents either was from or worked in Evanston. So he used to spend a lot of time in the Chicago area.
He's British.
I know.
Oh. All right. Pie. Did I ever tell you the circumstance in which I saw Pie?
Was it the Bruin View?
Yeah.
Which is a really weird choice for a Bruin View.
Here's the thing. I went to Bruin View every Thursday night to watch Dave's Confused at midnight. That's just what we did. It's like if you were looking for anybody, any of my friends, if you were looking for me, if you were looking for anybody from the Factory Theater in particular, back in those days in the 90s, where are we at Thursday night at midnight? We're at the Bruin View, and we're watching Dazed and Confused. That's what we just did. We did it every week. So one night we're there, and we're waiting for Dazed, and I can't remember what the movie was beforehand, because Dazed was always at midnight, so we were there for we saw the last half hour or whatever the 10 o'clock movie was. I can't remember what it was. So we're there, group of us, as we normally are, and so they make an announcement. We've been drinking. Obviously, you go to Bruin View. Back in those days, I was a drinking man. So we would go to Bruin View and we would just, you know, drink like maniacs. We would just pitcher after pitcher after pitcher of beer. So we'd had some to drink, and so we're all pumped up for Dazed and Confused, and so they make an announcement over the PA that says that they are canceling the screening tonight's screening of Dazed and Confused. And people were booing, and obviously, you know, this was like a last minute. I don't know how this decision was made. I don't know how poorly it was executed, but so they decided they were going to cancel it. They make this announcement: we are not showing Dazed and Confused tonight. And everybody was disappointed. Everybody was primed up. We'd had a bunch of beer. We were waiting for Dazed and Confused. We were waiting to know every single line and every single moment from the movie and have fun watching it like comfort food. They make this announcement that they're not going to show Dazed and Confused, but you can stay and see a brand new movie that we're going to preview tonight exclusively here, and it's called Pie. And so my friends were like, let's get out of here. And I was like, no, I want to stick around and watch. You know, and I did, you know. So that's how I first saw Pie, under that circumstance, drinking at Bruin View, pumped up to see Dazed and Confused, and then this thing happens, and I did not know what was going on. Written and directed by Darren Aronofsky, his feature debut, Pie only made $3.2 million at the box office, and it was a limited release with a budget of only $61,000. To add atmosphere to cerebral mathematics thriller, Aronofsky chose to film in harsh, grainy, high-contrast black-and-white reversal. In fact, it's closer to black or white, as the film... As the filming method all but eliminates gray tones, the result is a very different picture, which was fitting for a movie already unique in story concepts, music, and everything in between. So, yeah, I'm buzzed. I'm waiting for Dazed and Confused, and that movie comes on. I was just like, I don't know what the hell is happening. I don't even know what planet I'm on.
A math thriller.
I just don't even know what's... I mean, you've seen Pie. It's a very weird movie. And
super weird.
Yeah. Aronofsky tends to do that. You know, in the best kind of way, you know, making confrontational movies. That's one of the things that he does well. You look at Black Swan, you look at Mother.
Where does Noah fit into that?
I love Noah.
Oh, I don't know.
I love that movie. I think it's great. I think it's great.
I thought it was a bold, you know, if you're going to tell Noah's story, go for it. But I was just like, what is happening here?
Oh, no, I'm a fan. I'm a big fan. I'm trying to think of Aronofsky's movie I don't like. I don't know if there is one that I don't like. There are many that I love. Like Mother, I just, you know, that movie.
Got a really bad rap.
The Wrestler. God, I love The Wrestler.
The Wrestler.
Oh, The Wrestler. Yeah, no, Mother got, you know, I mean, people were just like, what is this?
Yeah, because he did Pi, Requiem for a Dream, Below.
Oh, Requiem for a Dream is the one that I don't like.
You don't like Requiem for a Dream?
I wanted to kill him during the last 15 minutes of that movie. I wanted to punch him in the face. It's brutal. I can't stand the last 15 minutes of that movie. I've never seen it. I could barely get up out of the theater. Way too much. So, all right, well, there you go. We're going to move on to some guilty pleasure movies. 312-981-7200. That'll be up after the news. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, here till 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. I am your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive on this Monday morning. It is Monday. That means my dad's going to call in and tell a joke because it's a jokey time. So we'll hear a joke from my dad. And also, there was a really good Hawks game last night, and we're going to play back the Blackhawks Express recapping that game. Hey, just coming up on the show here tomorrow, Amy Levitt is going to join us from The Takeout, and she's going to talk Halloween and fall food. And we're going to do an impossible slider taste test. You know, all these impossible burgers that aren't actually made of meat? Well, they claim that the best tasting one is the new impossible slider from White Castle. So we're going to do an on-air taste test. Wednesday, Edward McClelland is going to join us. He shares folk tales and legends of the Midwest. We'll do a round of Know Your Onion for Thursday. Dan Feinberg is going to join us for TV time, and it's the Halloween Spooktacular, because Thursday is Halloween. And then on Friday, to round out the week, Herb, the consumer man, Weisbaum, is going to join us, and we'll have the regular Friday features. So all of that and more, so please stay tuned this whole week. All right, 312. 981-7200. Guilty pleasure movies. We've got a bunch of them here. Like, for instance, the first one that's mentioned in the article, this is from Mental Floss magazine. The first one that's mentioned is, these are in alphabetical order, I believe. Yes. Anaconda. Which rules. I love that movie, Anaconda. And I think John Voight is pretty spectacular in it.
With his nondescript accent that could be from literally anywhere.
I have no idea what's going on. But that's got, like, Ice Cube's in it, Owen Wilson's in it, J-Lo is in it.
Yeah, Eric Stoltz.
Stoltz.
The best part about Ice Cube is that his first line in the movie is, "Man, today is a good day."
Is that right?
Yeah, he references today was a good day, and just...
I don't even remember.
Oh, God.
Let's see. Bad Taste. Peter Jackson's Bad Taste. I don't feel guilty about liking that movie. I can kind of feel guilty about Anaconda. But I don't... Wait. Whoa. What is this next? Wait a minute. Guilty Pleasure? Big Trouble in Little China? Guilty pleasure? What? Unacceptable. There should be no guilt at all for liking Big Trouble in Little China. Here's what they say. Though the gender and racial politics haven't aged perfectly, it's still fun to watch a young Kurt Russell as a macho truck driver helping a friend in Chinatown rescue his fiance from supernatural thugs. The special effects, fantastic soundtrack, and crazy chase sequences make for an enjoyable ride as long as you're not terribly concerned with character depth or development. But come on, just how many comedy fantasy martial arts movies are there, or at least ones directed by John Carpenter? Well, see, now this one, the next one makes sense. Bloodsport.
Oh my God.
That's a definition of a guilty pleasure.
Just for the training montage alone that goes on for, like, 20 minutes?
Bloodsport is fantastic. It's a fantastic movie. It is ridiculous. Based on a true story.
Wait, really?
Yeah, Frank Dukes is a real guy.
You're kidding me.
No. The guy
Wait,
that,
his name actually Frank Dukes?
Yes, D-U-X.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, real guy. Guilty pleasure, folks. Guilty pleasure movies. 312-981-7200. Paul says, my guilty pleasure movie choice is Black Sheep. Farley and Spade are great, and let's not forget Gary Busey. I can't go with you on Black Sheep. Tommy Boy, I'll watch at the drop of a hat. Tommy Boy, I adore Tommy Boy. It's one of my favorite movies, and it's a remote dropper. Whenever Tommy Boy is on, I watch it. But I can't go with you on Black Sheep.
I forget. Black Sheep is when his dad is like running for Congress, yeah, or something like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, 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 yeah. 847 area code says Mannequin is the best. I think you should feel guilty for liking Mannequin. You know who's embarrassing in that movie? Spader.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Wasn't there a sequel as well?
Yeah, Mannequin 2 on the move. With Christy Swanson. They couldn't get Kim Cattrall back, so they got Christy Swanson.
I mean, in terms of subtitles, you know, for
and a Andrew
movie.
McCarthy wasn't in the second one either.
On the move.
I'll tell you what, I got a guilty pleasure. Speaking of Andrew McCarthy, I love Weekend at Bernie's. I love that movie. That's a guilty pleasure. I think that one falls under guilty pleasure. I think Weekend at Bernie's is hilarious.
Yeah.
And Terry Kinney is unbelievably funny in it, even though he's just playing a dead guy.
Yeah, it is not a good movie, but it is a fun movie. It is a very fun movie to watch.
I have a blast watching that movie. 317 area code says, good morning, Nick and Tom. My guilty pleasure is the movie You've Got Mail. I will sit through that whole stinking movie just to see the end where they meet up in the park. You know, I don't hate You Got Mail. I actually don't hate it. I actually kind of like it.
I just can't imagine watching it in 2019, what that would be like.
Well, I still have AOL.
Yeah.
So I do get to hear that whenever I check in. Whenever I check in, I get to hear, you got mail. Body Double. Again, no guilt involved. Brian De Palma, director Brian De Palma, cribbed a lot from Alfred Hitchcock, but Body Double is more subversive, sexually charged, and more violent than anything Hitchcock ever made. Plus, it was made in the 80s, and everything looks very 80s. The L.A. film noir erotic thriller, Hollywood doesn't make those kind of movies anymore, allows actor Jake Scully, played by Craig Wasson, who's house-sitting for a friend, to become a rear-window-like voyeur spying on a sexy neighbor, played by Deborah Shelton. He witnesses her brutal murder and gets caught up in solving it, which leads him to a porn star named Holly Body, played by Melanie Griffith. And to him starring in a music video for Frankie Goes to Hollywood's Relax. Academics and critics have written a lot about the film. It's misogynistic or is it self-aware? Either way, while watching, we know it's not Hitchcock and we know it's not as revered as De Palma's Carrie or Scarface, but we watch, well, because we're all voyeurs too. Scarface was not revered when it came out. I can tell you right now that when Scarface came out, the only critic that liked it, the only critic that gave it a good review was Roger Ebert. Everybody ripped that movie to shreds when it came out. I remember because I saw Scarface like 25 times in the theater because I love it. I remember it got ripped to shreds when it came out. The critics were not kind to Scarface, particularly Pacino's performance. They really went after Pacino. I love that movie. I love everything about it.
I can't be on board with you.
I wish it was longer.
Well, it's already, what, like three?
Over 3 hours, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I love that movie. It's one of my favorites. All right, here's a guilty pleasure. Bram Stoker's Dracula. I can't go for this one. I can't. It's a terrible movie. Bram Stoker's Dracula is a terrible movie.
But Keanu's performance.
Well, Keanu's the man.
With a bastard sleeps.
I don't know. I don't understand. I remember being so disappointed by that movie. Mm-hmm. You know, I was really looking forward to it because I love vampire movies.
Sure.
And Gary Oldman's cool. No. No. All right. No guilty pleasure on that one. Just guilt. All right, let's take a break. We're talking about guilty pleasure movies. What do you guys have? 312-981-7200. Right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DeCilio here on 720 WGN. And, yeah, remember that classic video? Sting dancing around a bunch of candles. Oh, man. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DeCilio here on 720 WGN. It is a Monday morning. My dad's going to call in and tell a joke. We have a Blackhawks Express from yesterday, last night's game. And it's a good one, too. And now we're talking about guilty pleasure movies. What are some movies that you like, even though you feel guilty for liking them? Next one in the article they mention is Buffy the Vampire Slayer. See, here's the thing. Nobody understands this. None of my friends understand this. I can't get into the TV show, into Buffy the TV show. But I like the movie. And all my friends are like, how can you not like the TV show? And people have always, you know, have for years tried to get me to watch Buffy. Like, they would give me seasons of them on DVD, and I would just be like, I'm sorry, I can't, I don't get it. But I did like the movie. I thought the movie was pretty cool. Christy Swanson, again, boy, this is like the third time we've mentioned Christy Swanson. But yeah, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I got to admit, I do actually, I enjoy that movie. Let's see. Next one mentioned is The Burbs. Again, no guilt. I love that movie. It was released February 17th, 1989, just one day after Tom Hanks' first Oscar nomination was announced. Until then, Hanks had been primarily known as a comedic actor, but in the late 80s, he began his ascent to serious A-lister, but The Burbs remains one of Hanks' finest comedies, mainly because it's so absurd. Hanks plays Ray Peterson, a bored suburbanite who's on vacation. Instead of going out of town, he and his neighbors decide to spy on a new foreign neighbors, the Klopeks. They act weird, and Ray and his friends create a conspiracy that they killed another neighbor. The entire film takes place in a cul-de-sac, lending to the simple premise. Today, the film's influences can be seen in everything from American Beauty to The Summer of 84. And if you look closer, The Burbs is about distrust bothering people, white flight, paranoia, immigration, invasion of privacy. Oh, I had to sneeze. So, great movie. Burbs is a great movie.
I mean, it's no Bachelor Party.
Better than Bachelor Party. Don't be crazy, man. Bachelor Party is fine, though. I think Bachelor Party's funny. 773, boy, we got a lot of people who are texting in. People feeling guilty about liking certain movies. 773, Eric Coates, my guilty pleasure is Grease. People feel guilty about liking Grease?
I really hate Grease. I don't like it at all.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I don't.
But it's like a really popular movie. I don't say tons of people love Grease. Yeah. It's not too guilty, but maybe they feel guilty because they don't typically watch movie musicals.
It's not a particularly good one. 724 area code says my guiltiest pleasure: all of the low budget satanic movies that came out between Rosemary's Baby and The Omen, such as The Devil's Reign, Brotherhood of Satan, and Race with the Devil. I love all three of those movies. I love all three of them. Devil's Reign is classic. I remember, the big makeup effects that turn Ernest Borgnine into the devil, and that's like Travolta's first movie, and he melts in it at the end when it rains. All of the satanic people melt. It's such a stupid movie, but I love it. Race with the Devil rules.
Very good movie.
Race with the Devil rules. When Peter Fonda passed away, that was the first movie I watched. I know it's weird, you know, should have been like Yuli's Gold or something, but I went right to Race with the Devil.
Got to go for the deep cuts.
Oh, man, I love that movie. 847 area code says, I love Paul Blart Mall Cop, but just the first one.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I can't. I can't do it, man.
No.
Glenn in Evanston says, my guilty pleasure is, can you believe it, Gymkata. Gymkata's good, man.
I know.
773 area code Moonstruck. The scene where with Cher in the confessional makes me laugh every time. There's nothing guilty about Moonstruck's a terrific movie. That's John Patrick Shanley, man. You don't mess around.
I lost my hand. I lost my bride.
Yeah. No, I love that movie. 708 area code. Good morning, Mike. Well, it's Nick. But thank you. Guilty pleasure is Fast Times at Ridgemont High. John from Alsip says, hi, Nick. My guilty pleasure is Sky High. Oh, that's that Kurt Russell, right?
Yeah, that's a fun movie.
That is a good movie. I like that movie.
Him and Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman's in it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was
she's
a good...
Yeah, she's the principal and... what's her name? From Final Destination 3. I feel so terrible.
I can't help you with that.
But anyway, it's a great cast. It's a really fun movie.
No, I enjoyed that movie. I remember it came out the weekend of Flashback, the weekend that we had Flashback convention, because I saw it like right before I went to the hotel. Here's Ken on WGN. Hi, Ken.
Hi.
Hi.
I just thought of another one, Joe versus Volcano, Bubble Boy, and Xanadu.
Oh, Xanadu. Oh, boy, oh, boy, oh, boy. Yeah, that one fits in with the whole guilty pleasure thing for sure. So I think Bubble Boy is hilarious.
So do I.
Yeah, I think it's hysterical. All right, thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jake Gyllenhaal, man, Bubble Boy. You know that movie came out the same year as Donnie Darko.
Oh wow!
Yeah. You want to talk about completely different movies?
Yeah, not exactly birds of a feather there.
Yeah. 608 area code says, although not theatrically released, as a guy in his late 30s, pretty much any of the crappy formulaic Hallmark Channel movies, especially now that their Christmas season has begun. They're already showing the Christmas movies on the Hallmark
Channel. Yeah, they're going in on it. They're going in.
903 area code says, I love Hell Comes to Frogtown. Yeah, Roddy. Roddy Piper, man. Can't go wrong with Roddy Piper. By the way, very nice guy, Roddy Piper. He was a really, really nice guy. And he signed my They Live sunglasses. Yeah. All right. Here's a goofy movie. 815 area code says Super Fuzz from 1980 is a guilty pleasure of mine. I remember as a kid watching it on HBO all the time. Watching it now, it doesn't hold up. And my wife can't stand it. But I will always enjoy Terrence Hill's goofy performance. That movie's ridiculous, Super Fuzz. Super Fuzz. 218 area code says, Gone Fishing with Joe Pesci and Danny Glover was my jam when I was younger. You ever see Gone Fishing?
Well, it's two-thirds of the later Lethal Weapon sequels.
Yeah.
I have not seen that. What is that?
They're wacky and they go fishing. 847 area code says, my two are Dirty Dancing and Pretty Woman. I'm hoping they don't need to be scary. I bought them and saved them on demand to watch at least once a year. I love Dirty Dancing. No apologies for loving Dirty Dancing.
People love that movie.
I love it.
Yeah.
Can't stand Pretty Woman. I hate every frame of that movie.
I'm no one way or the other. Nah. I have no strong feelings.
It's an incredibly misogynistic movie. And, I hate that movie.
Hate it.
All right, here are some of the other ones. Cat in the Hat. Who the hell likes Cat in the Hat?
I used to love Cat in the Hat. With Mike Myers?
Yeah.
Oh, I used to love it.
Come on, man. That movie's an abomination.
I was a huge fan of Mike Myers. I know you don't like the Austin Powers movies either.
Hate them.
You hate those. I grew up worshiping the Austin Powers movies, and so when he was in Cat in the Hat, reminder, I'm only 25, so yeah. Think of when that movie came out. I was like, oh, nice. Austin Powers is the Cat in the Hat.
Oh, my God, that movie. Oh, here you go, Cobra.
There we go.
With Stallone.
There we go.
A terrible movie.
Oh, what are you talking about?
Marion Cobra Cobretti. That's his name. Cobra.
That is a stellar picture.
I remember, I've only seen it the one time, but I remember really liking his car. It's one of the coolest cars I've seen in a movie. Next is Cocktail.
Cocktail's awesome. Love Cocktail.
Cocktail's ridiculous.
That is a big mood.
All right.
Cocktail.
The next one we're going to save here till after the news because it's one of my favorites of all time. So we'll break. Guilty pleasure movies, that's what we're talking about. And we'll do some more of it after the news, which is up after this. Yeah, man. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGiulio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5, as we are every weekday morning. I'm your overnight dude, 1 to 5 a.m. Coming up a little bit later on, my dad's going to call in and tell a joke, because it's Monday, and it's a jokey-jokey time. We have a Blackhawks Express from last night's game to play back as well. But right now, we're talking about guilty pleasure movies. Movies that you really like, but you feel a little guilty for liking them. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. The next one in this article is one of the greatest movies ever made, Congo. Congo rules. Now get this. Okay, first of all, the opening sentence of this piece about Congo being a great guilty pleasure. Here it is. Are you ready?
Hit me.
Twilight star and future Batman Robert Pattinson has declared Congo, quote, a masterpiece.
Well, I mean, the man knows cinema.
Star of The Lighthouse. Congo rules. Here's the thing about Congo. I've said this before. Speaking of John Patrick Shanley, who wrote Moonstruck, John Patrick Shanley wrote the screenplay for Congo. And I think everybody was in on the joke that it was a comedy except Frank Marshall, the director. You go back, Congo is hilarious. It's hilarious. And it's meant to be. Released in 1995 and based on Michael Crichton novel, this Frank Marshall-helmed movie stars Laura Linney as Karen Ross, an employee of a telecommunications company. When a team is sent to the jungle, and come on, Bruce Campbell's in it. That's the first person you see in the movie. When a team is sent to the jungle to discover a lost city and are subsequently slaughtered, Ross assembles another team to see if there are any survivors. She's accompanied by Peter Elliott, played by Dylan Walsh. Whatever happened to Dylan Walsh? And his mountain gorilla, Amy, who is equipped with a backpack that allows her sign language to be translated into speech. Her go-to phrase, Amy, good gorilla. Ernie Hudson and Tim Curry also join in on the fun. In the jungle, the group finds not just the lost city, but a group of murderous white gorillas and an about-to-erupt volcano. Congo is the very definition of a it's-so-bad-it's-good movie. The VFX in the climactic fight are so terrible they're hilarious, and animatronic Amy doesn't look anything like a real gorilla. The acting is hammy, and it is a joy to watch. Yeah, I love it. I love Congo. Oh, next one on this list is, of course, Dante's Peak. Dante's Peak was, that and Volcano came out like right around the same time. Volcano was the one with Tommy Lee Jones. And Dante's Peak is Pierce Brosnan and Linda Hamilton. I don't remember either of them, really. They're just like volcano movies.
I love Dante's Peak.
And it was like Deep Impact and Armageddon came out at the same time.
Yeah, similar situation.
Yeah. How about The Day After Tomorrow?
I was terrified of that movie.
It's the only movie that I've ever seen where people are running from cold. I remember hating it. I just...
I was terrified of it because I had a thing about weather. For a little while, I had a phobia of inclement weather. Like, I used to be afraid of thunderstorms. I was really afraid of tornadoes.
Yeah.
So I was terrified of the prospect of that movie. And then I finally watched it on DVD, and I was like, oh, this isn't scary. They're just running from the concept of cold.
Yeah. The next one is truly a guilty pleasure, and I love it. Deep Blue Sea. I love that movie. Again, Rennie Harlan. And one of the greatest deaths of all time, Samuel L. Jackson. Shark jumps out, eats him, right in the middle of the big inspirational speech. That's classic. Deep Impact is here. Desperately Seeking Susan. Wait a minute. Wait. Why is that guilty? Why would anybody be guilty for liking Desperately Seeking Susan? It's a great movie. All right, we got some texts coming in. 219 area code says Car Wash. Yeah, that's a guilty pleasure. Because that's a pretty lousy movie. Great song. 919 area code. Napoleon Dynamite. Wife hates that movie, and most people my age, 67, I know, never saw it. I hate that movie, too. I know you love it.
Huge fan of Napoleon Dynamite.
Oh, I can't do it, man. I want to punch John Hader right in the face.
Oh, what?
I can't stand him. I hated that movie.
Tina, you fat lard, go get some dinner.
I can't stand that movie. It's, oh. 708 area code, Kentucky Fried Movie. Classic. Have you seen Kentucky Fried Movie?
Oh, yeah. It's Rex, was Rex something Danger Seeker?
Yeah. Oh, man. Kramer.
Yeah, Rex Kramer, Danger Seeker.
Yeah.
But that is about as off color of a movie.
Oh, the
as
whole
you can
movie.
Get.
No, the whole movie, man. You know, you look at this movie now and you're like, "Oh my god."
It makes Blazing Saddles look tame at times, yeah. Honestly.
But yeah, but Fistful of Yen, come on, man. That whole center, the whole centerpiece of the movie. UHF is a weird with Weird Al is a riot. People forget that Kramer is in that movie.
Yeah, Michael Richards.
Yeah.
I just like when he sprays the kid with the hose.
Yeah. That movie's funny, man.
Oh, it's super funny.
Yeah. Weird Al. You got to love Weird Al. All right. Next one here is the best guilty pleasure movies, according to Mental Floss, is Dolomite. Having a resurgence right now in popularity, thanks to Eddie Murphy. You know what? I don't know what they do in terms of movie. We can ask Feinberg this: if they do ratings on Netflix, if they have the like ratings, because everybody I know watched it.
Yeah,
even people who don't know what Dolomite is, you know.
Well, they're here for Eddie Murphy. I think I'm pretty sure they do, because when that horrible, horrible, horrible movie Bright came out, they were releasing all sorts of numbers saying, like, oh, yeah, if it had come out in theaters, this is how much money it would have made. And it was a total jump in terms of the actual numbers.
Also, you know what? I remember now, because when Bird Box was on,
yeah,
they went through the roof.
Well, and of course, you had the Bird Box challenge.
Yeah.
The single dumbest thing I've ever seen people do.
No, I mean, there's just so many stupid things people do, man.
What was it? Just like driving a car blindfolded?
Blindfolded, yeah.
It's just insane.
Yeah. And that wasn't a particularly great movie either.
No, I didn't care for it. I thought it was pretty beneath Sarah Paulson for Sarah Paulson being in it. Like, yeah, it was kind of beneath her.
All right, how about Drop Dead Gorgeous? Hilarious. You know who's hilarious in that movie? Is Ellen Barkin. Ellen Barkin is unbelievably funny in Drop Dead Gorgeous, which is a takeoff on, you know, teenage beauty pageants. But Ellen Barkin, I adore her in that movie. Clue. Why would you feel guilty about liking Clue? Tim Curry's in it.
I don't know. That movie's got a big cult following. I never enjoyed it all that much.
I like it. I know people who love Clue.
They
and have seen it
for it.
Oh, yeah. And have seen it over and over and over and over again. I mean, I've seen it a couple of times. I think it's fine. I especially like Tim Curry and Madeline Kahn. You can't go wrong with Madeline Kahn. She was one of the funniest women that's ever lived. Mm-hmm. But yeah, about it, people who are really obsessed with Clue.
It's beyond me. I don't know.
Con Air.
Yeah. Good look for Mr. Cage.
Oh, man, Con Air.
The single best movie about a bunch of prisoners on a plane.
I just put the bunny down.
Put the bunny back in the box.
Oh, God. Oh, here's a good one. I love this movie, Cruel Intentions. I love that movie.
Now, that's Witherspoon?
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's the brother and sister.
Wait. Yeah, plotting. Cruel Intentions. Yeah, yeah, it's Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that movie. The Da Vinci Code. Guilty pleasure. I know you like The Da Vinci Code.
I liked it. I was really into the book when it came out because I thought it was, wow, they did it. They exposed it. They exposed everything.
Yeah, right.
And I found out that, nah, it's totally fake. Everything in it is totally fake.
Oh, man, Devil's Advocate. I adore that movie. I mean, come on, Al Pacino, Keanu. Ella Enchanted.
Oh, I remember that.
Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
Guilty pleasure.
My teacher, I liked it because my teacher read that book to us in class.
Ah. Face Off. No guilt.
No. Face Off is amazing.
Face Off is awesome. Oh, this is a great one. Speaking of Reese Witherspoon again, Fear with Marky Mark. I love that movie.
When he starts pounding his chest.
Oh, yeah. And man, William Peterson is awesome in that movie.
Oh, he's amazing.
Flashdance. Yeah, no, I don't like Flashdance. Girls Just Want to Have Fun with Sarah Jessica Parker. I remember I saw that movie at the drive-in. So stupid. All right. Let's break here for some weather. We'll come back. My dad's going to tell a joke. We got a Blackhawks Express to play, and then we'll wrap up the show with more Guilty Pleasure movies.
Ooh, it's the best part of the week, baby. It's time to hear something funny. Here we go. With your music intro. Ah!
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Hey, what'd I say?
It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. It's a jokey, jokey, jokey time. Nick's dad tells a joke.
Ah, yes! Here we go.
Yeah. It's Monday morning. That means my dad tells a joke, and he does it every Monday morning. And also, the news is next, coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. But before that, I got to hear my dad tell a joke. So let's get him in here. Hey, Dad.
Hi, Ned.
How you doing?
Doing great.
Good. How's Ma?
Good.
Good. Okay, you got a joke.
Got a joke.
Yeah.
My friend got a PhD in palindromes. Now we call him Dr. Awkward.
Oh, wait a minute now. Hold on a minute. Hold on.
Okay.
All right, there you go. Dr. Awkward, see, because Dr. Awkward.
Dr. Awkward.
That's a pound.
That's it.
Yeah. All right, Dad. Thanks, man.
Same back and forth. Okay.
Gotcha. See ya.
Have a good day.
There you go. All right. The Hawks played a great game last night, and the morning after every game, we always play the Blackhawks Express, so here it is. Chicago!
United Center Ice for Hockey Fights Cancer Night with one last chance to end their current four-game slide before hitting the road for four straight. A win tonight evens the Hawks' record on home ice. A loss leaves them four games under the 500 level with plenty of questions to answer. You just don't want that. Well, down to center ice we go. It's going to be Taves facing off with Kopitar. To get it started, first of three meetings between the Hawks and the LA Kings is set to begin. And a little bit of a delay here. Referee has not stepped to the face-off dot to drop the puck. And now he gets the cue from the penalty timekeeper's bench. And here we go. The drop of the puck, we're underway. And the Hawks control off the draw. Brown has spun the puck down to the Hawk zone. Cuckoo's got it Hawk line. Bet it on the right wing to bring it over the King line to the right circle to Strome. He shoots, he scores! A toe drag and a snap shot from the slot. Dylan Strome from his old partner, Alex DeBrincat, snaps it past Campbell. And his second goal on the season gives the Hawks a 1-0 lead. To Kempe, top of the left circle. He fired that block. Kempe got it back left point. To Doughty, high slot area to Kopitar, top of the right circle, back to Doughty for a one-timer, and a big save by Leonard with the pads, a rebound and a scoop toward the net there by Dustin Brown, and Robin Leonard got the glove on out and held on. Head to Lizotte, can't clear the King zone, puck kept alive near the left point by David Camp with some good work. to Kubalik along the left boards. And Nylander left circle, closing the back out of the Kempe. He scores! His first goal of the season. David Kemp moving in front of the King down, and some hard work by that line. Nylander, Kubalik, and Kemp on the finish. And it's 2-0 Hawks. Inside the King zone against the inboards, Carpenter knocks down Drew Doughty as the puck deflects into the near corner. Ryan Carter gave it away. DeBrincat in front. Here's DeBrincat, right circle. Fed it to Strom. He shoots. He scores! Second of the night for Dylan Strom. Another hard wrist shot beats Campbell low and under the glove. It's now 3-0 Hawks with 4:05 left in the second period. Carpenter's got the puck, front of the Hawks bench. Enters the King zone on the left wing. Works it past Ryan down to the inboard. Got the puck to Strome, back of the net. Bennis left to bring it. Shoots! He scores! The Cat was quick as a cat right there. A perfect setup by Strome. To bring it, picked it up in the slot, turned around and beats Campbell with a wrist shot. And with under a minute to play here in period number two, it's 4-0 Hawks. Iafallo racing down the left wing side Hawk zone. Shot it across the rink and a shot from Walker. He scores. Robin Leonard was screened on this shot. This came from out near the right point. And I think Iafallo was trying to center that puck to one of the King players heading down the slot. They were all covered, but the puck banked over. It's actually top of the right circle, and Walker pounds it past Leonard. So no shutout tonight. 16:25 left in the third, and it's 4-1 Hawks. There's Hutton in behind the King net. Then to the far corner. Kane pokes it away to Kajula. To Kane back of the net to the left circle. And a shot there from Kuku. He scores! This deflects off of one of the Kings in front. It ends up into the back of the King net. Drake Kajula may have gotten a stick on this as well. And the Hawks now lead the Kings 5-1. At the right point, Roy fires. Redirected in on goal by Kovalchuk, but turned wide by Leonard. Gilbert spins it around off of Strome, sticking down ice. And this is going to end the hockey game. 3 seconds, 2-1. That's all she wrote. The losing streak is over. And the Blackhawks beat the LA Kings here tonight 5-1. Hawks will head out on the road for four games. With the win here tonight, the Blackhawks run their record to 3-5-2. But more importantly, they get out of the loss column and get back into the win column. And some momentum for sure as they head down to Nashville.
There you go. Heading down to Nashville. And that game is tomorrow at 7 o'clock. You can hear it right here on 720 WGN. All righty then. Let's see. We got a few more of these guilty pleasures. I'm going to hang on to this because we haven't even scratched the surface. We can do it again maybe tomorrow or something. But what about Hackers? Do you ever see Hackers?
Is Rob Redford in that?
No. No, that's...
Sneakers.
Sneakers, which is a good movie. Sneakers is a good movie.
Yeah,
Hackers is Angelina Jolie.
Yeah, from like 1995,
yeah.
And it's really poorly dated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that one was... I remember that movie had a pretty strong following when it came out. Like, people really liked that movie.
Because the internet was just so new.
Yeah.
And seemed to capture something.
All right, how about this? Halloween 3, Season of the Witch.
Why would anybody... That's not guilty.
No, I wouldn't think so, but I'll tell you something. When that movie came out, people hated it. Over the years, it's gotten the love now that it deserves. But when it first came out, people hated it. They hated it because, one, there's no Michael Myers in it. Two, it's got that ending. Nobody knew what to make of it when it first came out. I remember I saw it the Friday that it opened, and I went with a bunch of my high school buddies, and everybody hated it except me, and the audience booed. They hated it so much, and I was like, I thought it was great. I thought it was awesome.
And plus, you got the great Tom Atkins.
He's the king. Yeah, no, I love Halloween 3, and now, but seriously, it does now have a reputation that. People love it now. But yeah, no, it was not a popular movie when it first came out. People were really angry. So, Howard the Duck. Can't do the Howard the Duck. I like the Howard the Duck in the Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it's Seth Green.
Yeah. I like that, but I don't like the movie. from the 80s. All right. Guilty pleasure movies, that's what we've been talking about. By the way, for tomorrow on the show, Amy Levitt is going to join us. She's with The Takeout, and we're going to talk about fall food and Halloween and stuff. And we're going to do an Impossible Slider taste test. So we're going to talk some food tomorrow. So Amy Levitt will be here, and we'll have her on to talk food and do all kinds of other cool stuff.